Well, I think that's a tremendously atmospheric and kind of apocalyptic kind of song from Johnny Cash. Also been somewhat ringing through my head over the last week or so. So on tonight's show, I've got the main event really is Fred's talk on medicinal mushrooms. He was on the Sunday night. He was billed to be on in the Nature Dome, which is one of our smaller venues. But in fact, he went on in the Stars and Stones, which is quite a lot bigger. Last gig on the Sunday night, traditionally a graveyard slot, actually, it has to be said, as everybody's out there having some fun and getting their hair down or whatever it is they do nowadays. But as it was, Fred's talk was absolutely packed. He was working closely with Natasha, both of whom we had on the show live from the Green Gathering, giving us a little bit of an introduction to kind of what they were going to be doing there. Later on in the show, we'll hear a little bit of Fred's plant spirit medicine talk, and he'll be on the show next week live, and I suspect we'll probably be talking mostly about plants, although he does many other things, as we shall hear later in the show. In between the two things, I'm hoping to be able to give you a link to a slideshow of some pictures from the Green Gathering so that you can see some of the places that we were doing all of this stuff in, and so that you can see what a whole load of people who are not getting paid actually can do with their time when they're kind of given free run. But in the meantime, here's Fred talking about medicinal mushrooms, and this was a real ear-opener for me, this talk, I can tell you. Just so much amazing stuff, and if we're looking for solutions, certainly as far as health is concerned, then this is the one, really. Give this a crack. I'll be back with you in, well, it's, best part of an hour and 20 minutes long, but well worth it, and everything's quiet outside.
Okay, so in traditional Siberian folk medicine, in certain areas, the chaga mushroom, that's the black clinker-like one that you've got out there, is harvested and made into an extract using vodka. And it is said to be the mushroom of longevity. So they make this alcoholic extract, and you're supposed to take one drop for every year of your life. And it's supposed to prolong your life and give you vitality and good health. Okay?
I'll drink to that.
Now, we actually have, because Ardia over here has bought some chaga in for us to have a bit of a brew of. Okay, so we've got some brewed up chaga that's just been simmering on a low heat on the stove for about half an hour, and we're going to put some in a mug, and you can pass that around, and it's, you know, entirely at your own risk and all the rest of it, but you're
just keep it right off the boil. Then I find that a bit of a problem. You've got to have a wood burning stove, haven't you?
You've got to simmer it away quite gently.
What, simmer, like, not even simmer, surely?
I would say just about a simmer, yeah.
Because that is boiling.
Not a rolling boil.
I've got a book about chaga mushrooms, and it says when you boil it, drink something that's boiled, it's like a meal, so your white blood corpuscles. I haven't read into it, but have you heard of that?
I haven't, no.
And that's the reason not to boil the chaga mushrooms.
Okay. Well, I'm not sure I agree with that.
No.
Because
it's by that David Wolfe bloke.
Yeah, I don't.
Who wrote Naked Chocolate?
Don't know.
What he's a nutritionist from across the water.
Okay. What I do know, though, is that when you buy medicinal chaga extract, it's actually cooked at a very high temperature, yeah, which is completely conflicting with that. And it's cooked in a pressure cooker apparatus, and then basically the mixture is then distilled. So it's actually heated to a really high temperature. Okay? And one of the things about mushrooms we're going to learn about too is that they contain a group of polymers, right? And when we talk about polymers, we think of plastic, right? Okay? But these polymers are made up of sugar units. They're basically, carbohydrate is a polymer. They are, cellulose rather is a polymer. They're made up of saccharide units, sugars, bonded together in long chains. And the chains can be anything from 10 sugars long up to 3,000 sugars long. And the individual polymers, these polysaccharides, have different effects on the human body. But it's been found that when you extract just a single one, the effect is nowhere near as dramatic as taking the full spectrum of all of the polymers that come out of the mushroom. With, I think, one exception, actually, which we'll talk about too. And these polysaccharides seem to be one of the main magic ingredients in a lot of these polypore bracket fungi that grow on trees. okay? They're tough things, they're hard to break down. And so to get the full range of them, often they're put through very hot processes over quite long periods of time, and then also added to alcohol, which extracts the alcohol-soluble parts that wouldn't come out in the water. And then the rest is recombined to make what we call a full-spectrum extract. And that will have as many of the different lengths of polysaccharides from the mushroom in it as you can get out in one go. Okay? So that's what makes for the most potent extract. Can we have another? Here we go. So also, the tinder fungus that you've got going around, the other name for it is, just to mention that name because you'll see it by that name, is called amadou. Okay? And it was written about by Hippocrates in the 5th century BC as being basically a choice medicinal mushroom to treat inflammation. So even going back to classical medicine, it was in use then. There's a picture of your tinder hoof. Okay, the one that's going round. See the hoof shape? Every time you've got this sort of wrinkle going around the outside of it, that's a year's growth. It's like a growth ring. Next, please. Okay. So medicinal mushrooms have entered the field of research-based medicine in a big way now. Clinical studies and complex biochemical analysis is being done on a large number of species, but there are so many species out there. And if you go out mushroom foraging in the UK, you may find 3,000 or more different species of mushrooms, and only a tiny fraction of them have been investigated, and there's a lot more investigation to be done. Many contain compounds that we haven't even identified yet. Okay. Thank you. So, we talked about Paul Stamets. Who's heard of Paul Stamets? Yeah? Quite a few of you. That's good. Many see him as a figurehead of a mycological revolution, and his books and publications, as well as TED lectures, are bringing vital information to the forefront of the media. Okay, we're ready. I'm going to let him do the talking for a bit.
Discovering that which our ancestors long ago knew, that mushrooms are deep reservoirs for very powerful medicines. In the next 10 minutes, I'm going to describe four mushrooms which I think are essential for human health. The first mushroom I want to mention is amadou. Amadou was described by Hippocrates in 450 BC as an anti-inflammatory. Well, amadou is a birch polypore, but has other attributes as well. You can hollow this mushroom out in the center, put embers of fire inside, and keep fire alive for days. Moreover, if you boil this mushroom, it delaminates into a cellular fabric. And my hat is made from amadou. Now, another fungal friend I have here, which I want to unveil, is agaricon. Agaricon is the longest living mushroom in the world. It was described by Dioscorides in 65 AD as Elixirium ad longum vitum, the treatment against consumption. Now, this mushroom is a resident of the old growth forest. It is now thought to be extinct in Europe. It grows in Northern California, Oregon, Washington, and British Columbia. This mushroom survives in the old growth forest under extremely adverse conditions, hundreds of inches of rain per year, wind, sleet, hail, baking in the sun. And yet it's the longest living mushroom that we know today. So my partner and wife spent a lot of time in the old growth forest looking for these mushrooms. And to give you some idea how rare agaricon is, although we have 40 strains of agaricon in culture after 30 years, the largest library by far in the world, my dear professor, Dr. Michael Bude, discovered his first agaricon in the old growth forest just these past few weeks after looking for mushrooms in the old growth forest for more than 40 years. So agaricon has anti-tubercular properties, and we have now confirmed this working with the U.S. BioShield Biodefense Program under the guidance of NIH and U.S. AMRID. And sometimes we have to go to great extremes to find these mushrooms. This is a 700-year-old Douglas fir tree. Our team member ascends the tree. We go 100 feet up this tree, And this is the oldest agaricon that we've found so far, approaching 100 years in age. Now, how is it that this mushroom can survive under microbial attack? And it's able to do so because the mycelium is this cellular architecture that is based on a network concept. And we don't need to harvest the mushrooms, we get a small piece of tissue. And the mycelium, as it grows, utilizes what we know as epigenesis. It has the amazing ability to adapt its host defense strategies against pathogens. And using this information, we've been able to develop some very powerful gateways to new medicines. And these are extracellular droplets that we wash from the mycelium. And I'm happy to announce that we have discovered a new class of antimicrobials and antivirals called fomitopsterols, after the Latin name of this mushroom, which is Fomitopsis officinalis. So powerful are these antivirals that when we do 100-to-1 dilution, we are more powerful than ribavirin against flu viruses and herpes. Now, mushrooms have other properties which are interesting. And so this is a group of cordyceps mushrooms. They're known as entomopathogenic fungi, fungi that kill insects. And the insects are on a constant dire dance between dinner and death as they go through soils. And cordyceps is a source of cyclosporin. Moreover, just recently, the FDA approved Novartis for a new anti-MS drug called Gilenya, which is predicted to be one of the 10 most profitable commercially produced drugs in the history of medicine. But cordyceps has a different face. And the cordyceps is a mold, has a mold stage. And they're like two faces of the same organism. These spores are very infectious to these insects. And most insects have entomopathogenic fungi that can harm them. So they avoid them with great diligence. But I did something different. I took these cultures of the mold state and I morphed it in the laboratory into a pre-sporulating form. And so insects avoid these spores, but I discovered that if you took the mycelium without the spores, something else happened, which was truly amazing. They became super attractants. And they became super attractants to ants, to termites, and a surprising array of other types of insects. And so the insects, in this case an ant, becomes mummified, and then, oing, a cordyceps mushroom sprouts out of his head. So it goes full circle. Now, we did extracts, again, washing the mycelium, and we were able to find that termites would stream directly to the location where the extracts were placed, and three positive controls, and the termites would tunnel specifically to where that location was. Well, I started trying against other non-social insects, flies, gnats, and mosquitoes. And this is the baseline, the flat graph there is the control, and the only difference is we added the mycelium to the extract. And we have not just attractants, but I've discovered super attractants. So when I tried against mosquitoes, and this is where we hit the big home run, we can attract mosquitoes roughly equivalent to a human hand with the extracts. This has profound implications for disease control, from malaria to yellow fever to West Nile virus. And so what can we do? There's lots that we can do. I think we can now control disease vectors, zoonotic diseases carried by insects across landscapes. And since so many insects and arthropods vector diseases, most of you may not know that H5N1 bird flu is carried by houseflies. This is something that's not widely reported. But because of climate change, subtropical diseases are now entering into temperate zones. So being able to control zoonotic pathogens, I think, is one avenue that will have a positive impact in helping habitats and humans dwelling within those habitats. Moreover, insects and arthropods not only transmit diseases that afflict humans, but plants. So the implications of this, I think, is absolutely enormous. So we can increase the efficiency of bug zappers. We can steer insect migrations across landscapes. This is a paradigm-shifting, revolutionary breakthrough on the most fundamental of levels. And moreover, we can attract disease-carrying bugs and blend them with expired antiviral drugs, antimicrobial drugs, or the crude precursors that made those drugs. And we can create a panoply of a mixture of these drugs so the disease resistance would not occur. We can distract the insects away from human populations, away from animal populations, away from plant populations. Or we can bring them to a locus to be able to control them. Most of you have heard that the mosquito population on the East Coast was 10 times greater this year than it was previously. So another mushroom empowers the immune system, and this is turkey tails. And turkey tail mushrooms have also been used for more than 1,000 years. NIH funded our group with a $2.1 million breast cancer clinical study, which has been recently completed. Now, this breast cancer clinical study was dealing with a non-ER, non-estrogen responsive breast cancer patients, ladies. And the study has come back with some remarkable results. And when you, if patients have radiation therapy or chemotherapy, their immune system is oftentimes impaired, so natural killer cells are decreased. Taking these mushrooms as an adjunct therapy, not as a substitution, but to support the immune system, the natural killer cells increase on a dose-dependent basis. The red bar is no treatment with 3 grams and 6 grams per day. And then post-radiation, the immune system depressed, and then on a dose-dependent basis, the natural killer cells are enhanced over a period of 4 weeks. So this raises base immunity function, which I think is critically important. Now, this hit home to me very personally in June of 2009 when my 84-year-old mother called me up and said, "Paul, I have something very serious to talk to you about, but you're always so busy." It's a terrible thing to hear from Mom. I said, "Mom, what's wrong?" And she's a very happy, genuine person. She goes, "I'm worried." And my mother's deeply religious, has not seen a doctor since 1968. She said, "My right breast is 5 times the size of my left. I have 6 swollen lymph glands the size of walnuts," and her voice started shaking, and I'm not ashamed to admit that I started crying. "Why didn't you tell me so?" We spent a large part of June at the Swedish Breast Cancer Clinic in Seattle. The oncologist examined her, and upon the second examination, she had a 5.5 centimeter diameter tumor. It metastasized, it went to her sternum, it went to her liver. She had stage 4 breast cancer. The doctor gave her less than 3 months to live and stated it was the second worst case of breast cancer she has seen as a doctor in 20 years of practice. We had the circle family meeting. Many of you have gone through this. My mom announced that she bought a pine casket, the cheapest one that she could find, because she was going to heaven. But then the doctor said, "You know, you're too old to have radiation therapy. You can't have your breast removed. But there's an interesting study on turkey tail mushrooms at Pasteur Medical School. You might want to try taking those." And that's my mother goes, "Well, my son's supplying those." So she was put on Taxol and Herceptin, wonderful drugs. And then she started taking 8 turkey tail capsules a day, 4 in the morning and 4 in the evening. And that was in June of 2009. And today, my mother has no detectable tumors. And I'd like to thank my mother back.
So, quite moving stuff, really.
We've got some turkey tail, don't we?
We do. We have some turkey tail tincture with us, and we're going to talk about that in a bit too.
India, they've got a language in Orisha that has 20 different edible mushrooms and 20 that they, or maybe more, but also all their words are male or female except the mushroom.
Is that right? So
yeah.
It doesn't have a gender.
No.
That's interesting. Thank you. I'll file that one for later use. That's brilliant. So I don't particularly agree with his sentiments around controlling insect populations and things like that, because to me that's too much like meddling with the balance of nature. But the story about the turkey tail mushroom is really moving stuff, and there have been loads and loads of good reports about using turkey tail. And in fact, it's possibly, I think, either the most or the second most, I think it's the second most used adjunct to cancer therapy in lots of parts of the Far East. It's very, very popular. The turkey tail mushroom grows in the UK. It's very, very common and very, very easy to identify. And it grows on rotting wood, usually on hardwood trees. The majority of the time it's on hardwood trees like beech, chestnut, oak, that kind of thing. I've got a slide to show you of it in a moment, and I've also got with me a bottle of turkey tail tincture. Now, if you can identify this mushroom for yourself, it's very easy to make the tincture. I'm just going to have a quick root in here.
I think that one's got the decoction layer as well.
I've got the tincture here. This tincture is just made by drying the fruit bodies of the turkey tail mushroom and steeping them in alcohol, chopped up very, very small. Steeping them, we use good brandy. It's got to be over 40%. You can use vodka as well. And steeping them in that alcohol for 1 month, shaking it once a day. And after that, you filter it off, and what you have is the tincture of the turkey tail mushroom, which is a fantastic boost for your immune system, but it's also an immune modulator, and we're going to talk about what this word, immune modulator, means in a little while. So not only is it great for, it's the impact it's had on cancer treatment is quite widespread. It's news about it is spreading very widely, but it's also a very good boost to the immune system generally, because it promotes the environment for the T cells to flourish. Okay, so you've got these T lymphocytes, killer cells and the like. This will actually promote their production.
That's the decoction as well.
This is a full extract, yeah. Is it? Okay, so in this little bottle we've actually got... Remember we said to you that you can use heat and water to extract the water-soluble components and then use alcohol to extract the alcohol-soluble components. That's what's in this bottle. It's a full, what we call a full-spectrum extract. And we've actually used this, Tash and I, last year... to great effect, where lots and lots of people we knew were going down with severe respiratory complaints, and in fact one family that we know all went down with pleurisy, which is a nasty illness that is inflammation of the lining of the chest cavity, really, and it makes it very painful to breathe, and they were very poorly indeed, and conventional antibiotics didn't touch it whatsoever. After 3 weeks on antibiotics they were no better and sort of hardly able to walk. And 3 days of turkey tail tincture, and they were up and about and almost completely better, because what it had done is kicked their immune system into touch, and their own immune system had fought the disease rather than the antibiotic doing the fighting. Their own immune system had done the fighting. Okay, now feel free, again, entirely at your own risk, but it's not in any way toxic. Feel free to have a couple of drops of that if you want to know what it tastes like. I'll pass the bottle around. Is that okay, Tash? Yeah.
There somebody said they grew a load of psilocybin. I don't know whether they mature, but they put them into a tincture.
Yeah.
And then they crystallised it, and apparently they could smoke the crystals.
Why don't they just eat mushrooms?
Yeah, but you couldn't tell they were. I don't know exactly. You could be right.
Yeah. I'm being a bit flippant and stupid on purpose, so don't be offended. My advice to that person is go buy a chemistry set.
Taste the bread.
And eat mushrooms.
Yeah.
But I don't know if that would work or not. I have no idea. But it's interesting. And I can't see why you couldn't extract the active ingredients and crystallise them out. I think that would work. But I think it's quite a complex process. So that's the turkey tail tincture going around. Well, it's a full spectrum extract, and it will reach you quite soon. Can we have a slide, please, Tash? Okay, so what's in medicinal mushrooms? Well, there are lots and lots of things in them. A lot of the things are not identified currently, but there are a whole range of stuff. There are antioxidants in massive, massive quantities in some of these mushrooms. Chaga itself has got higher levels of antioxidants than almost anything else you can think of from the plant or mushroom kingdom. Vitamin D itself is an antioxidant, and a lot of mushrooms are extraordinarily rich in vitamin D. Even the white mushrooms you get in the supermarket, okay, have small amounts of vitamin D, but if you put them in the windowsill where they can get sunlight for 3 days, the amount of vitamin D in them increases by 30 to 40 times. Yeah? So they're grown in the dark, in tunnels and cellars and old mines and things like this. Before you eat your mushrooms, get them out into the open and get daylight on them for 3 days, and they then become supercharged with vitamin D, which is a really good thing to know.
Is that the same for the brown ones as well?
Yes,
yeah.
It is. The polysaccharides we talked about...
White would reflect more, wouldn't it? It's a bet they put...
It would.
The darker one might
but it's
be
absorbing the energy of the sun, and there's a biochemical reaction going on in the mushroom where it then starts to manufacture more vitamin D, because the fruit bodies, once they're cut, are not dead. They're not dead for quite a long time. A mushroom doesn't have sap vessels like a plant that it has to be plugged into to stay alive. Okay? All of the cells are independently living, and as long as they have sufficient moisture and they're not overheated or over-chilled, frozen, they'll stay alive and carry on developing until the thing has done its job and produced spores.
That's why they open up.
Yeah, exactly. They're still living.
Yeah.
They're still living. And so they'll manufacture this vitamin D for you, and there's way more vitamin D in them than, you know, a couple of supplement pills. The polysaccharides we were talking about are really, really important. Particularly a class of them known as the beta-glucans. Most mushrooms contain some beta-glucans polysaccharides of different lengths, some of these polymer sugars, in a vast array of lengths and configurations. They're not simple chains. They've got all sorts of side branches with nitrogen on and hydroxyl groups and all sorts of stuff. They're all different. There are loads and loads of them. And most of those are powerful immune modulators, and we're going to talk about this word modulator and what it means, because it's important. It doesn't just boost the immune system, it does something really special. They also contain organic acids, for example, the betulinic acid in all of those birch mushrooms that we handed around, which is a powerful therapeutic agent. They contain melanin, and strangely, it turns out that melanin actually seems to have an action in the body that helps the body to fight melanoma. How strange is that? And many other compounds, alkaloids being one group, which in many cases are unidentified. And when they do identify them, they give them a name, which basically sounds like the name of the mushroom with just a few letters added on the end. And then this whole study has to take place about what it actually does. So this, you can't see it very well, but this diagram at the bottom is part of a polysaccharide chain, and it's actually cellulose, which is in itself a beta-glucan polysaccharide. It's found in a lot of mushrooms as well as in the plant kingdom. Next one, please. Okay, so immunomodulators, what are they? They are said to be able to trigger or heighten an appropriate immune response, as well as reduce or terminate an overactive immune response. So that does, I think, sound like magic. But what actually happens is it works on the production of T cells, T lymphocytes. And T lymphocytes, these white blood cells that basically help you to fight disease, specialise into different forms.
That
so,
almost like antihistamine as well. So,
let me think about that, Nolan. Let me think about, I'll come back to you on that one.
But definitely good for the diseases that are caused by the body's immune response.
Yeah.
Attacking itself, as it were.
Tremendous for those kinds of things.
Yeah.
Basically, there are some T cells whose job it is to gather information about the illness and remember what the illness looks like. Okay, they're memory cells. There are some which are killer cells that actually attack foreign organisms or potentially attack cancer cells as well. Okay, but there are also some that are called suppressor cells, and their job is to recognise when things are becoming too inflamed and there's too much activity going on, or when the disease process is tailing off, and they shut down the immune reaction. So not all T cells are about fighting. Some of them are about measuring how well it's going and recognising the illness process, and some of them are about shutting it down. Okay? So an immune modulator, which most of these medicinal mushrooms are, although they work on specific parts of the body very often, actually has the ability to get your immune system to fight in that area, but also to tell it to back off when it's too much. Hence the anti-inflammatory effects, for example. Okay? So what none of them do is overstimulate the immune system. They actually balance the immune system. They optimize it so it works the best it can, and they make sure it shuts down the process at the right time. Okay? Which is fantastic. Really incredible. So a new class of drugs, really. So that's a T cell, okay? Not sure what information you can gather from that, but I thought it was quite pretty, so I'd stick it on a slide. But there they are. We're full of them. We have lots of them. Okay. And
why
it
the,
doesn't look like the letter T.
Like eating big, fresh fly agarics, then? This boat had a carrier bag on, like, you could see him feeding it, like...
Do you know what?
The
I'm going to tell you a story about fly agarics in a minute as well, that I think you'll find interesting, okay? In fact, I'll do it now. I'll do it quickly now. We found so many fly agarics last winter, didn't we, Tash?
Yeah.
That, I mean, we thought we'd died and gone to heaven, basically. We thought we were in Wonderland, obviously, and we were waiting for the white rabbit to appear. We even found a rabbit hole, and down the rabbit hole, I'm not joking, we've got photos to prove this is real. Down the rabbit hole, there were fresh new fly agarics down the rabbit hole, growing out of the sides of the hole in one place, yeah? And that must be where they've been carrying the spores in and out on their fur.
Yeah.
And I have heard it said that they actually like to eat them, but I don't know if that's true.
We didn't see any rabbits.
They're all down their holes with their little paws up in the air, you know? What we did find out, though, when we came across what we call the fly agaric forest, where there were more fly agarics than trees, what we walked around and said to ourselves was, surely you must be able to eat these.
Free food.
Free food, okay? Well, it turns out you can. And in some cuisines around the world, again, among indigenous peoples, they are eaten as food, not as an entheogen, but as a meal, okay? Just one second. And the simple truth of this is, they are actually food if prepared correctly. So many foods we eat are actually toxic if you don't prepare them correctly. Like runner beans can even be toxic, and kidney beans certainly are. Okay? But all they do with the fly agaric is they put in about a tablespoonful of vinegar and a teaspoon of salt in the boiling water. They peel the red off of the caps, usually, and they boil them for about 10 minutes, okay? And you might think that makes them go mushy, but it doesn't. They can be cooked and they firm up really, really nicely.
They go crispy.
Now, the thing is with it, to do this, you have to use enough water. It's not just the heat. You're actually extracting the toxins in the water and you tip away the water. So it's no good just using a little bit of water, because it can only cope with dissolving a small amount of the toxins. You have to put them in quite a deep pan of water. Yeah, and then you tip that water away, and the solid mushrooms that are left remain firm, and they cook very nicely, and they're non-toxic, okay? And this is actually done around the world in lots of places, and in fact, there's even a restaurant in the States that serves it now.
In New York.
Can I say, I was in a squat once, and I ate some fly agaric that was semi-baked in them, they were still milky, and everything I ate for 10 days tasted of
fly agaric. Yeah, so that's not how to win friends and influence people with cookery.
The proper way to do them, shamanically or whatever, is by the fire.
Yeah.
Because dries
it concentrates.
Them
what actually happens is it creates a chemical reaction where much more of the entheogenic substances are produced in the mushroom, and they concentrate in the cap cuticle in the top part of the mushroom. That is what it does, and it also. That chemical process detoxifies it to some extent as well. Some of the things that make you sick turn into the stuff you want, so they become less toxic as well.
Could you just say what's that word, entheogenic?
Entheogenic.
What does that mean?
It's a word that's in use a lot at the moment, and it basically means plants and mushrooms that can be used as mind-altering substances for spiritual practices. Okay, so the definition of an entheogen is not being used just for recreational use or to get off your head. Yeah, entheogens are not used in that way. Okay,
entheogens being different from ethnobotanical then?
Ethnobotanical is to do with the study of herbs and mushrooms and how they fit into cultural practices. Yeah?
Right.
So, but the word entheogen means actually using them for spiritual practices. And not always as something you ingest either. Not always used by swallowing or inhaling or whatever. Sometimes used as energy medicine as well. Working with the spirits and the energy directly. Okay, that doesn't look like the letter T. So how do we use them? We can use them as immune modulators, complex antibiotics, ones that it's very unlikely that anything will ever become immune to, because it's such a wide range of complex compounds in them. They're not just, you know, that the bacteria are not just getting used to one chemical that they have to learn to create a defense to. There are thousands and thousands of different compounds in these. Promotion of T cells, leukocytes, etc., as anti-inflammatories, as tonics, blood sugar modifiers. Some of them have the ability to regulate blood sugar levels. Even reversing insulin resistance in type 2 diabetes to some extent. as antiviral agents, specifically against particular viruses, very often like influenza viruses, anti-tumour activity, modifying metabolism of cholesterol and reducing the amount of cholesterol that's being deposited in the body, as adaptogens. The word adaptogen is a bit like something that enhances overall vitality and health, a bit like ginseng would do. Okay, as a source of enzymes, this is one, this is a really good one. I'll tell you about phytase in a minute. And also, in general, if you look at the cultures that have used mushrooms as medicine, throughout there is this story that they have to do with longevity, well-being, and having a long and healthy life.
Maca is an adaptogen.
Sorry?
Maca.
Yeah, so I've heard. I've never experienced it, though, but I've heard
it's
that.
It's from the Alto Plano in Peru, and it's like a multi, loads of minerals and stuff in
uh-huh.
it. It's a root.
Uh-huh. So ginseng's also
it's very popular
adaptogen,
in all
yeah?
smoothies and chocolates.
Yeah, it's a faddy thing at the moment, but it doesn't mean it's bad. It's probably very good. Yeah, yeah.
So
chocolate is also...
Food,
I reckon
it?
Chocolate's a bit of an adaptogen myself, to be honest. I just want to go back to this button mushroom thing again. Now, I'm severely intolerant of wheat gluten. And I'm really actually quite allergic to it. Anyone here got problems with wheat gluten?
With
struggling
what?
With eating wheat? Wheat? Wheat
yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah, very much.
I had a hairpin the other day, cost me 38 quid. I've got to stay away from wheat.
Yeah, but it'd probably make you feel a lot better. Now, if I eat wheat, I'm sick for 5 days. And it acts to me, in my system, like a poison. So first of all, I get dry, cracked skin. My eyelids crack. I get wheezy. My sinuses get blocked up. I get cystitis. I get stomach cramps. I get diarrhea. And it works its way down my body from the top to the bottom, and it lays me up really badly for 5 days. So it's quite severe. Now, on one of our mushroom courses, what we do at the end of the day is we're harvesting edible mushrooms, and what we do is we do a big sampling session. We're piling up the mushrooms in the frying pan. You know, hate to say it for you vegetarians, but a bit of bacon as well, and some piles of bread. And I had my own bread, which is wheat-free bread. You know, it's a bit like polystyrene. In a separate pile.
But oyster mushrooms are crispy bacon mushrooms.
Fantastic. They're fantastic. But there I am frying it up for everybody, and it's getting dark, okay? And I'm the last person to eat the mushrooms, and it's too dark to see properly, and I stupidly use the wrong bread. So I've got two big, thick doorstops of lovely, you know, farmhouse loaf in my mouth, stuffed with mushrooms, and I'm chomping my way through it and going, this is great. And then you said to me,
what are you doing?
Isn't that the wrong bread? At which point I was like, oh my god, what am I going to do now? And then something dawned on me in a flash, because I've been researching the ingredients of mushrooms. Now, certain mushrooms that grow from the soil and compost plant material are called saprobes, and they make their living by composting plant proteins, breaking down plant proteins. And they do this because they manufacture an enzyme called phytase, and that's what breaks down the proteins. Okay? Now, phytase is manufactured in our gut by tiny fungal cells. Often candida, the one that causes thrush, for example, is partly responsible for manufacturing the phytase that we need as well. It's not always a bad thing, candida. And I obviously don't have enough of them, right? So this is what I found out. So what I did was I went, right, what's a saprobic mushroom? I know, I'll get white mushrooms from the supermarket on the way home. I'll buy a punnet load. And I ate a punnet of raw button mushrooms. The next day, I ate two mushrooms every 2 hours. And I had no symptoms whatsoever. I was not ill in any shape or form. And since then, I've repeated it deliberately. Again, same result. And I've now given it to 3 or 4 people who've come to me with IBS-type problems related to eating wheat. And they've all said that they either had no symptoms or almost no symptoms as a result of eating the raw mushrooms. Okay? So it's just a really simple thing that you can try. They also have compounds in that absorb the kind of byproducts you get if you've got a really sluggish digestion. So some people get really bad breath, for example, if their digestion is very slow. But the phytase goes in there and does its work, and it will actually also deodorise bad breath caused by sluggish digestion and that kind of thing too, and possibly help with wind. Okay, so
right, with next, button mushrooms, you said. What
Yeah, just the white cultivated mushrooms. The reason I use the button ones is because they're really nice to eat raw. Because it won't work if you cook them. It breaks down the enzyme. They've got to be raw. Okay? Now, lots of mushrooms can't be eaten raw, safely. But obviously, white button mushrooms, field mushrooms, etc. can.
What's the advantage of eating them raw?
It stops the enzymes being broken down in them. It's the enzymes you're trying to get out of them. If you cook them, it destroys the enzymes, so they won't work. Yeah. Okay. So, we're just going to look through the profiles of a few. Did that chaga make its way round, by the way? Did everyone get a sip? There's more here. There's more here.
Lovely.
Top up and go round again. Just top up and please pour.
Queen of mushroom.
So this is reishi.
Queen of mushroom.
This mushroom, you haven't seen it. Oh, okay.
You call it the queen of mushrooms.
Yes. Hang on. The mushroom samples that went around, where did they end up, by the way?
I've only got one little chaga here.
Can they all come this way? Because there's some people here who haven't seen them yet who came in a little later. So if you can pass them all this way and then they can get a look at those. Okay? So this is reishi, and this mushroom doesn't grow in the UK. If you want to use this mushroom, you have to import it or import a commercially made extract. But it is... again, probably in the top two or three mushrooms that are used by people with cancer in the Far East, okay, to boost their immune response. It maintains normal blood glucose levels, so it's very useful for people with diabetes. It's specifically active against bacteria, but only the type that are in the Bacillus genus. So bacteria that are actually called Bacillus, it will work against those as an antimicrobial, but it won't work against all bacteria. And it has a tonic action on the heart and the liver, so it's now being trialled as a treatment for hepatitis B with some good results. Okay? Tasha? Slide, please. We're going to flick through these. This one you will find in the UK, the maitake, or hen of the woods.
It's gorgeous as well,
it's, yeah, it's one of the tastiest things you will ever put in your mouth. The flavours are so complex, it's really good to eat. And individual specimens can sometimes weigh 50 pounds in weight. Okay? And you'll find that on an oak tree, or a beech tree, or a sweet chestnut, usually.
Is it common?
Reasonably so.
Is it?
Yeah, reasonably so. We found several last autumn and the
you
one
you can buy them dry as well.
You can, yeah. Japanese stuff. They're expensive to buy. You imagine if you get one weighing 10 kilos, you know, you've got enough there to keep you going for a long time. So, again...
Dancing ladies, they call them, don't they, or something like that?
I've not heard that one, but I can see where they get it. It's known to be effective to some degree against HIV. It reduces cholesterol. It's another immune modulator, and it again supports the body to fight cancer. Now, when somebody's undergoing cancer treatment, their cells go into a state called oxidative stress, okay? And the antioxidants in a lot of these mushrooms and the polysaccharides help to reduce this state of oxidative stress. So the body's cells that have been damaged by radiation and chemotherapy recover much more quickly and get back into fighting shape much more quickly. Next slide, please. Beech, oak and sweet chestnut, mostly. Sometimes.
Around the base.
Yeah, always at the base of the tree, that one. It's got a beautiful fragrant smell and it's soft to the touch. But it is a polypore. It has the sponge-like surface underneath. Okay? Now, in vitro research, okay, test tube-based research on the maitake mushroom, the hen of the woods, can induce apoptosis, or in other words, cell death, in cancer cell lines, human prostate cancer, also hepatitis 3B cells, SGC-70901 cells, and murine skin carcinoma cells. So these are lab strains of cancer and other diseases. Small studies with human cancer patients revealed an extract of the hen of the woods or maitake mushroom known as defraction, which has got just a certain range of the polysaccharides in it, has anti-cancer activity. And the US FDA has approved an investigational new drug application for a portion of the mushroom. So they're satisfied that not only is it clinically safe, but it actually works. Next one, please. Then we've got the birch polypore. Now, this one is one of the ones that Rob... This is the one that Rob bought and the one that's going around. That's a picture of it growing on the tree. Okay? That's the picture. Next one. Birch polypore, which is incredibly common in the UK. Every single birch wood in the UK is infested with it. I've not found a birch wood yet that didn't have it growing out of the trees. Okay, that's how common. It's effective against intestinal worms, anti-inflammatory, antimicrobial, antibiotic, antiprotozoan. It concentrates the betulinic acid, is also active against malignant melanoma. That's the dark, nasty, invasive form of skin cancer. And after repeated boiling, if you can cope with the flavour, is also edible. Next mushroom,
it's
please.
You know, like birch sap, they make that xylitol out of it.
Yeah, yeah.
That's alcohol-based as well, isn't it?
Well, it's an oil, yeah. Anything
it's
with oil on the end is an alcohol.
It's got a carbon molecule less or something.
But I don't know about that, but I do know it's an alcohol. Definitely. Thank you. I'll have a swig of chaga too. This one you will also find everywhere in the UK. These are woody, hard brackets. They're growing out in the woods here on the oak trees, okay? They take quite a few years to grow. It's called the artist bracket because the white, spongy surface underneath, if you make an impression in it, put a bit of pressure on it with a stylus of any kind, a little piece of wood or a pin, you can draw on it and it produces dark brown, almost black lines. And in Eastern Europe, huge specimens of these are sometimes found on people's mantelpieces, dried out, with whole landscapes etched into them in fine detail, and then they, you know, they last a lifetime. In Chinese medicine, this is known as ancient Ling Qi, this mushroom, and it's the second most venerated mushroom after the reishi. Next one, please. It's a close cousin of reishi. It's also an immunomodulator. It's tumour inhibiting. It stimulates interferon production, which is part of the body's own immune response, and is currently being used in China and in studies in the US to treat rheumatic, TB, HIV and esophageal cancer, cancer of the esophagus. Next one. This is our turkey tail. You may have had a little drop of the full spectrum extract as it went around. You'll find this everywhere in the UK. It's really, really common mushroom. And one of the reasons I'm doing this talk, okay, is because I think a lot of this stuff may find its way to the shelves of Boots the Chemist at some point in really expensive little bottles with names on that you won't recognise, okay? But the Green Gathering is all about empowering the grassroots culture, and you guys and me and everyone else here being the reason that we are going to make a change in the world. So if some of this knowledge can go out via this route, if you can learn to identify these things, use them and pass that knowledge on to your children and your friends, you're actually doing something good. You're changing the world, okay? We're going to talk about how to pick mushrooms so as not to decimate mushroom populations, though, in a minute. Now, and I know you want to say something, I'm really sorry, I'll be with you in 1 second. So, the turkey tail has, back again please, Tash. It's called the turkey tail because of these zones, which, if you look at the way a turkey's fan, when it spreads its tail out, a turkey fan, all the tail feathers, it has these zone coloration, which is where it gets its name. But the colours can be really variable. They can be orange, they can be pinkish, pale brown, purple. Different trees have different strains on and the colours will be different. They're soft to the touch and rubbery. They're small, only about this big, okay? 3 inches, 2 to 3 inches across, maybe that to that. And underneath, they're clearly polypores. They have the sponge surface that makes you know that they're not toxic. Because they're growing out of wood and they have this sponge surface
white,
underneath.
White or cream.
Good. The sponge surface must be white or cream. If it's brown or orangey, you've got the wrong mushroom. Yeah? It's a white or cream sponge underneath. So if any of you are taking notes, that's an important thing to write down. Now, if I'm out camping in the woods or on a long hike or anything else and I'm starting to feel poorly, sick for any reason, think I'm going down with something, one of the things I'll do is pick this and just chew it. Just chew a lump of it, okay, and it normally picks you up. But this is the mushroom we used to treat pleurisy and chest infections last year. As a cancer medicine, it's mostly used for the digestive tract and for of the respiratory tract for the chest and for the stomach and the colon being the main things, and also for breast cancer.
Turkey tail, they say if you dry it and store it out of light, will store for up to 10 years. Basically, if you see it, pick it, dry it, and put it in a box.
And store it. Yeah. Okay, as long as you keep it in a cool, dark place and sealed, it will keep, for a very long time indeed.
Yeah, because they come in flushes.
Can I get your question, please?
I was just going to say, never take 5 grand mushrooms if you're drunk. It's a bad idea.
It doesn't sound like a good idea. No.
I was wondering if you had anything to say about the lion's mane mushroom?
I don't, actually. Other than it is cultivated quite a lot as a medicinal mushroom in the East, isn't it?
But it's good to replenish broken nerve cells in the brain. It's good for Alzheimer's.
I honestly don't know the answer to that. I don't. And it could well be true, you know. Lion's mane, yeah. That's something you can get from Chinese supermarket suppliers pretty cheap as well. Rather than going through the internet and buying expensive extracts, the dried lion's mane is used in Chinese cookery, and you can get big bags of it for a fiver. You know, it's not expensive if you go for the right places. Sorry.
Can I ask what the turkey tail could be mistaken for?
It can be mistaken for... It's got a hairy cousin... which is also, this is a Trametes, it's got a hairy cousin, it's also a Trametes, slightly furry on the surface. It's not toxic, yeah? I don't think anyone's actually figured out if it's got the same properties or not, but my guess is it would be fairly similar. And there's also an orange lookalike, which is a bit smaller and quite hairy, quite furry, but that's got orangey pores underneath as well, and that's called the hairy Sterium, or Sterium hirsutum. And that is also a medicinal mushroom, although it has a different spectrum of properties. It's also an immune modulator as well. Okay, and it is not toxic, although I think that one may have some laxative effects. Next one, please.
Could you, with those...
We've done that one, have we?
With the turkey tails...
No, you haven't.
With the turkey tails, do you pick them when they're fresh or let them...
Fresh.
When they go hard, they're not so good then.
If they dried in full sun and they'd just gone crispy in full sun and they didn't look as if they were rotten, at a push I'd use them because they've just dried. But you've got to watch that. You don't want to eat any rotten mushrooms.
And are they always that blue colour? They're not a brown?
No, they can be brown,
green,
grey, cream,
white,
pink.
Plain white.
Also, even pure white, actually, once we've found them. So the colour with the turkey tail is not important. The banding is. The bands of colour. We'll do that next slide then. Okay, so this is possibly the most often used support for conventional cancer therapy in the East, along with another mushroom called Agaricus subrufescens, or the royal agaric. It stimulates immune response, and one fraction of it, called polysaccharide K, is considered particularly effective for breast, stomach, esophageal, lung and bowel cancers. The preliminary studies appear to show a reduced rate of recurrence of cancer. So if the person takes this and carries on taking the mushroom after the cancer has gone into remission, there's a much lower chance it will come back. It stimulates a very good immune response against infections too, particularly respiratory tract infections or RTIs, as we said, pleurisy, etc. Moving on to a different mushroom. Who's seen this? Very common.
Yeah.
Good. Growing on elder trees in the UK. It's got a close cousin that's eaten in the Far East quite widely as food. This is also edible, but it doesn't taste it very much. The name Jew's ear is a bit misleading. Originally, it was called Judas's ear because of the biblical story, or the biblical folklore, really, that Judas Iscariot hanged himself on an elder tree. So in Europe, they used to say that was where he hanged himself. And it's supposed to be his ears coming out of the bark of the tree to show everybody that that was what he did. It's quite jelly-like, and immediately if you put some in your mouth, it feels very cold and fleshy. And next thing, please, Tash. It is actually, in herbalist terms, it is a cooling medicine. It's a cooling anti-inflammatory medicine. It's also an anticoagulant. It thins the blood. And this one actually reduces white blood cell production a bit. So it's one of the things medically you could use to balance somebody's blood if that was what needed to happen. It has anti-tumour properties. It lowers LDL cholesterol in the bloodstream. Rabbit studies, heaven forbid, have shown activity against aortic cholesterol plaques, okay? So those are cholesterol plaques that adhere to a certain part of the heart. And it's traditionally boiled in vinegar and used for quinsies and other infections of the mouth and throat. Things that would give you a sore throat and nasty pustulant lumps or big boils on the gums, that kind of thing. This traditionally in folk medicine was boiled up and used as a gargle for those things. Okay, so that's worth bearing in mind.
Probably worth saying don't fry them.
Oh yeah. If you decide to eat Juzir mushroom, there's a special way to prepare it. If you just bung it in the frying pan, something really bad happens, although it's quite fun the first time. It's got a tough skin on both sides, and inside the jelly-like stuff turns into steam. And it turns into great big bubbles in the frying pan, which explode, fly through the air at about 50 miles an hour, stick to the ceiling with a whizzing noise, believe it or not. But if you're unlucky, they catch you in the eye, and that's not so good. So I recommend you don't do that, except for maybe an experiment with goggles on. If you want to eat them, that's not the way anyway, because they're not nice like that. What you do is you chop them up into shreds, finely shred them so they're like shredded seaweed. Then dry the shreds, put them on maybe a baking tray or something and dry them in a low oven or on top of a heater, or if you've got a dryer, dry out the shreds in the sun maybe. And then when you're doing stir fries and things like that or risottos, you put the dried shreds in and they partially rehydrate, but then they're firm and the flavour is concentrated and they're a lot nicer. So that's the way you cook them. You need to shred them and dry them first, okay? But it's a really useful mushroom. But back to the chaga here. This is a really nice picture of the chaga. It's a piece that a friend of mine gave to me. And you can see in the sclerotica there, you've got rotting wood, you've got the whitish areas that are actually active mycelium. And usually it doesn't smell of much other than rotting wood, but if you get a really active piece, as one of the pieces I handed round to you was, for weeks it had this incredibly strong smell. It was like rich cocoa. The smell, it was absolutely incredible.
Well,
yeah, and it was also slightly cinnamony, but later on after storing the smell goes off. However, still just as active, it doesn't make any difference to how active it is.
Where do you find that fruit?
You need to go north, the nearer you get to the Arctic the better. In England you can get it in the extreme northern counties and in Scotland, okay, but it doesn't grow anywhere south of that. Next one, please. So, the chaga, or clinker fungus, traditionally thought to be effective against certain cancers, coronary heart disease, liver disease, blood detoxifying as well, and promotes libido. There you go. So, it has phenomenally high antioxidant scores. Really, really huge sometimes. It depends, though, on where the mushroom comes from. They're not always massively high. It concentrates the pigment melanin from the birch trees, which is thought to aid with this oxidative stress that occurs with cancer treatments and also stress from radiation. It has a wide spectrum modulation of the immune response. So it's actually a great immune booster for loads and loads of different illnesses. It's not too specific. It assists the body to regulate blood sugar, and it is thought to have a general alterative tonic effect similar to herbs like ginseng. So it's an all-round good egg, really. White button mushrooms, here we go. I told you about what happened with my wheat allergy with white button mushrooms, and it's something I encourage you to try because it's certainly perfectly safe to eat raw mushrooms, and you'll get all that lovely vitamin D as well, and beta-glucans, there's lots of it in there. This is really interesting. So this comes from the International Journal of Cancer Medicine, and it was published about 4 years ago. A 2009 case study, control study of 2018 Chinese women correlated a large decrease in the incidence of breast cancer in women who consumed mushrooms, and this was white cultivated mushrooms. Consumption of raw mushrooms daily was associated with a 64% reduction in the incidence of breast cancer. Those who combined it daily with drinking green tea as their daily regimen, their daily habit, reduce the risk of breast cancer by almost 90%. Those are really phenomenal figures, and that was quite a large population study that was done by the Chinese. In certain regions of China, eating a salad with sliced raw white mushroom in is pretty much a daily practice as a starter with a meal. And also in certain regions, green tea is the main tea that is drunk. So it was very easy to plot that against control studies. And as I mentioned before, it's also a good source of phytase for breaking down long chain plant proteins like gluten. So if gluten gives you bother, try it. Okay, next one there.
Brad.
Sorry.
Just, with this, the first bullet point, how many mushrooms did they have daily?
It was the equivalent of 2 mushrooms a day.
They just had 2
yeah, mushrooms a day. Yeah, just a few grams.
Just two raw mushrooms a day.
And they weren't organic either.
No.
Okay.
No. Just two. That's it. 2 mushrooms a day. But the key is every day. Yeah. So it's always in the system. It's always in there.
White butter mushrooms.
Okay. So you're using it like a supplement, not just thinking, oh, I'll have 10 today and then tomorrow. It's 2 a day at least. Okay. This is the one we talked about earlier, which is the other number one cancer treatment adjuvant in the world, really. This is the Royal Agaric, Agaricus subrufescens. And I just thought I'd put a picture there to show you.
Is it grown in this country?
It doesn't, but a close cousin of it called the Prince, Agaricus augustus, does grow in this country.
It tastes of marzipan.
See,
awful.
The Prince looks almost identical. And just like Agaricus subrufescens, the Prince really strongly smells of marzipan and tastes of marzipan. So if you love marzipan, you will love this mushroom because it is actually edible. If you hate marzipan, you'll detest it.
Literally half a cap in a risotto and the whole risotto tastes of marzipan.
Yeah. You love it or you hate it. The young ones are that almondy and sweet that you can actually make desserts out of them.
What are they ones grow in the wood, do they? Like
they grow on woodland things. Edges, usually.
They look like hinky cat things, those.
Yeah, they're not, though. They're more like a horse mushroom, but speckly on top.
Is it?
Yeah, the almond smell is the giveaway. You must have the almond smell. Okay, otherwise it's the wrong mushroom.
Not to be mistaken with those shaggy, little shaggy...
No, I know what you mean, though, the shagginess.
They'd be nice with chocolate and cream, then.
They would be, yeah. Yeah, the young ones really would be. So... This is, I don't know for a fact that the Prince mushroom in the UK has the same properties, but I will say that in terms of resemblance, if you put a photograph side by side, you won't be able to tell the difference, okay? I'm just waiting for the announcement probably one day that it's actually just a different strain of the same species, and the smell is the same. It regulates blood sugar, may reverse insulin resistance in type 2 diabetes, has tumour-inhibiting properties, immune modulation, and reduces cholesterol. Naturally, that one is found in South America, but is being cultivated elsewhere in the world because it's highly saleable. It's very expensive to buy as a medicinal mushroom. Okay.
Sorry, Fred, again, for the regulation of blood sugar, you just need to take 2 raw ones a day.
I don't know about the quantity of that. You'd have to research that one.
Okay.
But it's usually pretty phenomenally small quantities with all of these. Shiitake, who's eaten them?
Yeah.
Yeah, we love them, don't we? Delicious.
Yeah.
You don't like them? Fair enough. Everyone's got the same taste.
Yeah.
Some of you may not know. Now, this, you know, we were saying about eating mushrooms raw. You can't eat shiitake mushrooms more raw. You mustn't. Okay. 2 or 3% of the population have a violently severe allergic reaction to raw shiitake mushrooms. Don't risk it because it can just happen. You might be fine one day. The next time, you won't be. It usually doesn't kill people, but they come out with a tiger-like rash all over the body, like literally tiger stripes all over their body.
Could you take a tiny bit then?
I personally wouldn't.
Wouldn't you?
No. But lightly only needs light cooking, and then it's still very medicinal, and it's fine. Okay? So the shiitake has, again, great immune modulating properties.
And you can make tea with them.
Yeah? You can make tea. Powdered shiitake is really...
Japanese make shiitake
tea. Yeah. Fantastic for chest infections. Shiitake is particularly good for chest infections.
That's the soup that they make in China, isn't it? The shiitake soup with the broth.
Yeah.
For colds.
For colds, yeah. Respiratory tract. So that, here we go. Second, right, apparently shiitake in Japan is the second most, whereas the others were over the whole Far East. Additional cancer therapy. It has active hexose correlated compounds in it. I don't know what that looks like. I wouldn't know one if it bit me on the arse. But instead of being a beta-glucan, it's an alpha-glucan, okay? And it's protective and active against liver cancer and prostate cancer. Other ingredients in it can be used to treat hypercholesterolemia. This is this tendency for a person to basically have very high cholesterol levels, and it's often genetic. But it can produce an allergy when consumed raw. And I should add to that list also, you know, there is this potential of severe allergic reaction if you consume it raw. So never eat shiitake fully raw. Always give it a light cooking.
Because it's powder, I presume that's raw then.
Yeah, the drying process probably neutralises that. But normally you're going to then pour hot water on it or put it in a dish.
Okay, yeah.
So what you wouldn't want to do is put the raw powder in capsules and swallow the capsules. You need to incorporate it. Yeah, I think that's quite dodgy, personally, okay, yeah, potentially. Okay, is there another slide? So, okay, we did that bit. Okay, so just to conclude the talk now, what I haven't done...
If you warn it about those mushroom shiitakes, then, because I'm sure I've had them before.
I don't know is the answer.
The thing is, it's 2-3%, but the reaction's quite violent. Yeah.
I don't think most people have, you know, the majority of people don't die of it, but you will come out, you'll look like a tiger and feel very ill. It does. It has a very strange lenticular rash all over your body, long streaks, long dark streaks all over the body.
How long do they last for?
A couple of weeks, I think. You're thinking about doing it, going out there. Tiger skin. You should buy a onesie. Right. Safer. So how, in addition to commercial extracts that can be obtained from lots of sources, Amazon now, if you go onto Amazon, you can buy mushroom extracts from all kinds of manufacturers around the world. Be choosy, okay? But you can learn to harvest or cultivate your own. It's not as hard as people would lead you to believe. And the harvesting side, probably 3/4 of the world's most popular medicinal mushrooms grow in the UK and are actually common, okay? So it's really worth getting your head and your teeth around this. Preparations that can be made include teas, alcohol inks, extracts, tinctures, fluid extracts. We talked about tincturing things in brandy and vodka, didn't we? And how if you do the decoction, the boiling first, and then add the boiled portion to the alcohol extract, you're creating a full spectrum extract that's got the aqueous, the water-based, water-soluble components in, and the longer chain polysaccharides that won't dissolve in water will come out in the alcohol, and you can recombine them to make a full spectrum extract, just like the turkey tail tincture that's gone round. Mushroom powders can also be consumed in capsule form. So a turkey tail, for example, dry powdered turkey tail mushroom would be okay to take in capsules, but with shiitake it wouldn't. You really do need to do the research to find out if the mushroom you want to consume is safe raw. That's important. Okay. Mushroom soup, if it's lightly cooked, will have a lot of the beneficial effects. And for some of these woody bracket mushrooms, even quite heavily cooked, which would soften it more, would have the therapeutic effect. But some of them, like reishi, and like the ancient lingqi, the artist bracket, are so woody that no amount of boiling will ever make it edible.
So
you could drink the broth.
Yeah, you can drink the broth.
But the actual mushrooms, there's no way you'll chew your way through them. They are like pieces of wood. Okay?
Yeah,
that's the last thing I need to say to you guys. I'm encouraging you, and I've told you that if it's a bracket fungus with a sponge underneath instead of gills growing out of a tree trunk, that it's not toxic. Make sure it's not growing out of a poisonous tree, though. Be careful about that, because they do take chemicals on from the tree. Don't harvest from yew trees or laburnum trees, yeah? But what I haven't told you is one last thing, which is very important. Mushrooms, just like everything else in the wildlife that we've inherited in this beautiful world, can become extinct if they're over-consumed and over-picked. Yeah? There are some mushroom species, edible ones, that are already threatened from over-picking. Now, the British Mycological Association has issued guidelines on picking. Bearing in mind you're only taking the fruit body, so it's like picking an apple from a tree. But it contains the spores, and these are the seed, in effect, of the mushroom. So if you take them all, it can't reproduce. What you need to do is make sure you never take more than 1/3 of what you find there. As long as you stick to below 1/3, it will all be fine. The ecosystem will balance itself. One mushroom can produce millions and millions of spores, just one fruit body. But if you start harvesting the lot, then you really are going to be having a deleterious effect, a negative effect on the environment, which would be awful, because basically it's supporting you with these wonderful medicinal mushrooms. But I wish you luck, and I want to encourage you not to be afraid of them, but just to do good research. And they're all out there for the taking, as long as you do it respectfully.
Yeah.
These two books, both by Paul Stamets, come highly recommended. The one on the left, although it's now a few years out of date, so there's a lot more research been done since, has lists and lists of all of the scientific papers that back up this mushroom research. So when people say to you, there's no research base to any of that, actually, there is a research base to almost all of it. Yeah? The majority of it. And there's more coming out every year. Dozens and dozens of new papers are coming out backing up this information. Yeah?
My understanding is that medicinal mushrooms don't interact with orthodox drugs, herbs, etc.
Mostly. Not entirely. For example, if you were consuming the jelly ear, the jew's ear from the elder, that does thin the blood. So if you were taking anticoagulant medicines, it would increase the thinning of the blood and it might make the blood too thin, for example. But in general, their effect is alterative, which means it's an all-round boost, but it doesn't push anything too far in any one direction. Or the immune modulating effect is the other main effect that we're seeing, which again has its own built-in cut-off mechanism because of the suppressor T cells are also getting a boost from it, and so that they're going to shut down more effectively.
Is it alterative in herbal medicine means you change your blood? Is it?
No, it's like, Sarah, you're a medical herbalist. Can you explain alterative for me, please? Is that okay? Sorry to put you on the spot.
I'm a bit scared, actually.
Okay. Well, that's quite alterative in itself.
Can we have that slide again?
Yeah, sure, yeah. Can we have the book slide again, please?
Yeah.
The second book is a great, big, thick, really enjoyable book full of pictures and diagrams and all sorts of stuff, but it actually tells you how to grow a lot of them. Okay.
If you want an ID book, the only one we recommend is the Roger Phillips book.
Yeah.
If you've got the Collins Pocket Guide,
bin it
because it's deadly.
Yeah.
It will kill you if you follow the instructions of some of the mushrooms.
Yeah. Roger Phillips, for anyone who can't hear, it's the only mushroom guide that I guarantee you is 100% safe.
It's like porn as well.
There's almost 1,000 photos, yeah? Every stage of development, accurate colour reproduction, cross sections, you name it. There's still only a third of the species you can find here, but it is all the commoner ones, certainly, and most of the rarer ones. But all of the other mushroom books are great for having a flick through, but the Collins one in particular, not the little gem, not the tiny little pocketbook
one.
It's about this, it's tall, about that wide, very narrow, with a plastic jacket on it, with colour photos on
it. The National Trust shop sell them.
Yeah, they're all over the place. There's information in there about certain mushrooms, particularly the blusher and one or two others, that will kill you if you follow it.
Yeah.
It is deadly. I mean, they've been written to...
You can trust the National Trust.
Yeah. Yeah.
So what was your recommendation?
Put it in the bin.
Roger Phillips.
Roger Phillips mushrooms is highly reliable. It's also discount on Amazon at the moment for about £12 or something.
The Mushroom Cultivator by Paul Stamets is a real good book, isn't it? I could read it over and over again.
It is that nice, isn't
it?
And he talks about wearing hats with basically that are full of psilocybin spores, so wherever you go you're spreading magic mushrooms around. It's quite nice. But
you have an illegal hat.
Yeah.
Properties of like psilocybin mushrooms,
I will just briefly touch on that. Now, as far as I'm aware, with psilocybin mushrooms, which is probably the only one I know anything about in detail, I don't think there have been any medical studies around immune modulation and things like that. But what is going on is nowadays there's some research going on to say that they may be very good antidepressant drugs.
Yeah.
Okay.
Now,
a lot of people here may know that already. However, let's all just remember, I bet most of us here know one or two people who've used psychedelics and actually come off worse, right?
Yeah.
It's not always a guaranteed good benefit, is it? So I will say with some caution, but there is now research coming out that shows in therapeutic doses it's actually good for depression.
Paul Stamets, if you Google him, there's loads of videos online that he's done, and he is literally like the mycelium god. He also has a 90-minute video going through all of the psilocybe mushrooms around the world, looking at the science of them.
Yeah.
And it's incredible. It's very science-heavy, but he literally goes through all the whole lot. You can get it on YouTube.
Yeah, you can get it on YouTube.
Yeah.
He's an amazing guy because... Sorry, mate. He's an amazing guy because on the one hand, he's this professor of mycology and he's like literally doing some dodgy research funded by the US Defense Department and things like that. He's also got a mushroom cultivation business where he's selling fantastically brilliant potent mushroom extracts for medicinal use. And then he's attending the World Psilocybin Conference and telling everybody how to grow different strains of cubensis and things.
Did he find one psilocybin in Colorado and got loads going, didn't he?
Yeah, it was a strain that was very uncommon as well. Yeah. But there were a few poisonings though, because it resembles a little gallerina mushroom very closely. Some people got hold of his work and thought they would go out and harvest it. They harvested the wrong mushroom and ended up dead. So be careful about that. Sorry?
I was going to say, there is somebody who's doing research on cluster headaches as well. He's doing a proper trial.
Okay.
I can't remember what his name.
I wish you knew. Crikey, that's...
But he's sort of... I think he's doing it, but it isn't legal what he's doing.
But the trouble is, I mean, it's probably hard to get funding anyway for a lot of that research.
But, you know,
they're
actually
funding more because they know what it can do.
Yeah.
But Paul Stamets...
More intelligent.
Well, yeah.
More self-deterministic.
Paul Stamets is also doing loads of research for the US government using mycelium to clean water. You know, like amazing stuff's coming out of it. They use mycelium to take radiation out of soil in contaminated areas, and Paul's leading all of that. So, they're growing insulation from mycelium blocks and all sorts of things. So,
just
do
incredible.
Have a look at the videos. It's
even now, growing something that's a bit similar to polystyrene foam in texture.
Yeah.
Growing it into molds to create panels for houses, car dashboards.
Something like 5 times more insulation.
With
polystyrene, you can have like mycelium will just like fill a web of like cornstarch or whatever. Mycelium will turn into a packaging.
It will. It grows its own matrix. Yeah. It's amazing. He's also developed. This is one last thing we'll throw in. Okay, in his lab. He's been growing strains of mushrooms, and even one species can have many different strains. And he finds certain strains have a unique property whereby if you put an organic poisonous chemical near them, something really hideous like dioxin, or in fact it was the nerve gas sarin in one case, okay, onto the Petri dish, the mushroom mycelium, as it starts to spread across the dish, when it reaches the poison, stops for a little while, and then after a few days, if you examine it, under an electron microscope, you can see it's growing crystalline materials, brand new compounds that are designed to break down the toxic material. And he's developed mushroom strains that actually create brand new chemicals that will break down sarin nerve gas contamination in the soil in battlefields.
3 cheers for Paul Stamets.
Yeah. Can we have the mushrooms and tincture back down here if they're not ready, please?
Is it necessary to say something like mushrooms and pollution, is that a big issue with absorbing mushrooms?
That is a really good point. Now, the one thing that mushrooms will do, some mushrooms, not all mushrooms, some mushrooms will accumulate heavy metals, which is one of the reasons why they can be quite good for decontaminating sites. But obviously some radioactive isotopes in areas that have been contaminated with radiation actually have high numbers of radioactive heavy metals in the soil, and the mushrooms can become quite radioactive. If you're buying commercial mushroom extracts, it's often worth checking to see if they've come from an area of the world where that may be the case, and also if they've been tested. It's very simple also.
Sustainably sourced as well.
Yeah,
because
that's important.
There's huge problems, and particularly in North America, where they're literally stripping the forest for medicinal mushrooms.
Yeah. Make sure it's coming from a reputable source, or do it yourself sustainably and carefully. With the chaga, you must actually carefully saw it from the tree. Do not use an axe because you will damage the bark and the trunk of the tree.
Never pull mushrooms, always cut them.
Yeah.
You wouldn't want your limb pulling off.
Yeah. If you slice the mushroom off, Tash is quite right, you slice it off, you're leaving a little stub, and that behind that stub, all the mycelium threads are still intact. And with a lot of these bracket fungi, they can even grow another fruit body onto the stub. If you pull it off, you're actually going to stop it doing that. Okay.
Well, even with a beefsteak fungus that grows in...
Yeah, beefsteak will grow back if there's still enough season.
Can you pull
left.
It off, that one?
Yeah, cut it off, don't pull it.
Cut
it off.
Yeah, cut it, slice
always
it off
cut it.
With a knife. Always cut it.
Was that same for like ground-based mushrooms as well, like a puccini?
Yeah,
or
always, you know, always. The only time you'll pull it out of the ground...
Times, and a lot of books will say just like twist them off.
Yeah.
Cut it, just slice it. You know...
If you look when you pull it, at the bottom will be the mycelium.
Sure.
Yeah. So you're actually damaging the mycelium.
Even if you're just dislodging it, you're not doing it any favours because it's right. Breaking contact with the soil.
So if you get
back to the radiation thing. You know what? You can get a Geiger counter from blackcat.com. Okay, I think it's .com. Just look for Black Cat. You can plug it into your USB port on your computer and it will print graphs. It's very, very sensitive. And it will show you if it's above background count level regards radiation. And all you've got to do is put your chaga or whatever mushroom in front of the little window on the Geiger counter and see if it starts clicking away. And it will give you a reading. It's not hard to do. So if you're picking your own and you are seriously worried about that, especially if you're in a region of the planet that may be contaminated with radiation, then it is really quite simple to do, to test. Okay.
We still need the tincture back.
Yeah.
A bit of chaga.
I think we've got another bit of chaga out there somewhere. Can we have it?
Can I make some chaga?
Yeah, please do.
There's a bottle of tincture.
It's the bottle of tincture
well.
About. Thank you, Doctor.
Thank you.
It came back to me again, so I had to have another go.
Brilliant. So I'm up a little bit myself.
Fred Gillam and Natasha, folks. That was really
good. Thank you all.
There you go. Fred Gillam, as I said, and Natasha. And I've listened to that interview probably 3 or 4 times over the last couple of days or so, and I hear more stuff in it every time. For those of you who don't know, Fred's website, I've just posted it in the chat box here at peoplesinternetradio.com, where we're seeking solutions, and there was plenty of up-and-coming solutions in there, I suspect. Fred's website is thewildsideoflife.co.uk, and in there you can find his remarkable blog, which I posted the address for earlier. It's on page 7 apparently, and it includes not only stuff on mushrooms but coracle making, mushrooms foraging courses and mushroom safaris, charcoal making, how to make herbal remedies, how to make some of those things that he was describing there, together with an article on roadkill and how to tell if it's safe to eat. Because Fred also does field butchery, and I noticed from his website when I went there the other day that he also does devil-headed Viking axe throwing. So he's truly a versatile geezer. At the very beginning of his talk, he used some material from Paul Stamets, who I thoroughly recommend going and having a look at his fairly large YouTube output. A lot of very interesting stuff there. There's a website called... www.fungi.com, F-U-N-G-I is how that is spelled, and that was a website founded by Paul Stamets in 1980. It's got quite a lot of stuff on it that's worth looking at. I wasn't able to identify specifically the books that Fred's talking about at the end of that talk, but he's written a book called Mycelium Running, which if you're only going to read one mushroom book, I reckon that's a good one. And the chances are that if you read that, you're going to want to read more. He also done one called Growing Gourmet and Medicinal Mushrooms and another one called The Mushroom Cultivator. As Fred said, these things are a lot easier to do than you might expect. He's also done a book called Psilocybin Mushrooms of the World, which is going straight onto my Christmas list, without a doubt. And they also mentioned the Roger Phillips mushroom book, which, as I posted in the chat box, is like mushroom porn. They've got every kind of photograph of the mushrooms. They've got spore prints for them as well, because you can leave a mushroom on top of a piece of paper. And over 2 or 3 days, it will leave its own specific spore print, like a fingerprint, but for a mushroom. So that is that's a really, really cracking book to have. And in the talk, I mean, it really is a remarkable stuff. The Paul Stamets told about how it supports and revitalizes the immune system, which is the single best thing we can be doing for ourselves, because we are a walking pharmacopoeia. We have within us the ability to deal with all manner of outside threats. As I've said before, the whole thing seems to be fundamentally geometrically based. It's like we've got like little locks inside us, and all of the stuff in nature around us is like a chemical key that is designed to open doors that are shutting themselves. I didn't know about immunomodulators, I must admit. Spent a bit of time looking at the immune system myself. But there's evidently this really effective policing system, which not only encourages it to rush into action, but also tells it when it's achieving the right level of activity. And all of these capacities of the immune system appear to be strengthened by a vast variety of mushrooms. I think in Paul Stamets' story about his mother and the encounter that she had with the doctor, who told her that it was the most advanced case of breast cancer she'd ever seen in 20 years or whatever it was of experience, and that, you know, she was going to die in X number of months. This is a classic example of the nocebo effect, which is the opposite of the placebo. It has been most definitely demonstrated that better news and a good bedside manner and all that kind of stuff are probably, they are certainly a significant variable in whether or not somebody recovers. And we heard how these mushrooms, I mean, the list was huge, how they can help combat flu viruses, indeed any virus, herpes, that there's a possibility, because they are so complicated, that resistance to diseases itself could be more or less eradicated. They're extremely potent against breast cancer. One of the trials that he quoted there suggested that women, and indeed men, because breast cancer is not limited only to women, by eating simply 2 cultivated white button mushrooms a day, sort of sliced and raw, it's not difficult to chew your way through a couple of those. They actually taste quite nice. And as many of us have discovered, if you do something 6 or 7 times and it doesn't actually kill you, your body will get to like it, and your kind of taste buds will adjust. And that seemed to show, at least in that particular trial, a 96% reduction. I mean, that is absolutely astonishing. Also, Fred was pointing out that if you leave the button mushrooms on a windowsill so they get a little bit of the old sunlight, get a bit of the pattern from the pater, father, son, then they will also accumulate, or I suppose metabolise, vast quantities of vitamin D. So these things can actually be used as a supplement. Fred told a story about how some friends of his went down with respiratory tract infections to the point where breathing was really painful. This is a bit like my tooth story earlier on, would generally mean going down to the general practitioner, who is practicing only, and getting yourself some kind of heavy cocktail, which you would really, at the same time as taking, need to take some kind of promotional measures for your immune system, because tend to attack everything that's in there rather than just what's wanted. But mushrooms appeared to clear that up in all of his friends within 2 or 3 days. We heard that it fought melanomas generally, not just breast cancer, but prostate cancer and urine tract carcinomas. Fred told another story about how his own gluten allergy was overcome by eating, once again, the white cultivated button mushrooms that we're so used to eating and cooking. He emphasised that it's important that they're raw. So overcoming gluten allergy, having a gluten allergy, that is. And there's a trial that suggests that it improves people's condition who've got hepatitis B, HIV, esophageal cancer, throat and mouth infection, loads and loads of stuff. So the darn things are cholesterol lowering, blood sugar modifying, antiviral, antibacterial, anti-tumour, adaptogenic beasties, and all of that. And they also, apparently, according to Wisdom Worldwide, lengthen your life, not to mention the fact that they've seemed to also be able to decontaminate land from things like, or at least work towards it, from things like radioactivity and sarin gas and many of the other things that we've done to the planet. So as soon as we change our minds about the way it is we are allowing things to be run, there are solutions apparently in the Mushroom Kingdom to so many of the things that apparently seem to be completely overwhelming. And as Fred said, one of the reasons he's doing the talk is because without doubt the reason why people like the Food and Drugs Administration, another very interesting name, are experimenting with these things is because without doubt they want to synthesize them and then patent them and then make them theirs. And what Fred wants to do, and it's a good green gathering concept, it's one of the things I really like about the place, it is designed specifically to empower the grassroots, as it were. And as he said, something like 75% of the mushrooms that are used as major medicines throughout the world, not here for some obscure reason, are not only available in the islands and lands of Albion, they are common here, which I think is as good a place to leave it as any, apart from the fact, of course, that it would appear that as well as all of the decontamination and the health benefits, in the long run, we might be able to make not only dashboards for motor cars or machines out of them, but we might also be able to use them to replace all of this polystyrene stuff that comes from the fast food places, so that at least we've got something that kind of decays and goes away by the time it's shortly after it's been used. Absolutely amazing. I will try and get the podcast for this show up this weekend so that people can have another listen to that, because Fred's amazing. There was so much information in there. We will be hearing a little bit more from Fred Gillam towards the end of the show. He's going to we're going to have a bit of a 15-minute extract from his plant spirit medicine talk, which he talked a bit about in the live show that Dr. Rock did from the Green Gathering. And next week we will be having Fred live on the show, and I should imagine that it's the plant medicine that we're going to be talking about mostly, although any questions about mushrooms and stuff would be more than welcome. So I'm going to put on a couple of tunes. I'm just trying to find a link here. I'm going to put on a couple of tunes, and at the same time, what I'd really like to do is give you a bit of a tour of the Avalon Rising site at the Green Gathering and what we were doing, and a bit of a look at the festival as a whole, because I realise not everybody has the benefit of being allowed into these places by pretending to be useful, which is what keeps happening to me. So the actual website is internetradio.dr-rock.biz. That's internetradio.drrock.biz, written as dr-rock.biz. download/green-gathering.2014, and it's a downloadable PDF. It's about 6 megabytes, I think, best part of 36 pictures. And after the next couple of tunes, I will just talk you briefly through those, and also, you know, gives you pictures of some of the four talk arenas that we were running. Once we'd set it all together for 3 days, there was activity going on in all of those places, and we'll have a quick look at the menu of what was happening there, because people complain, you know, about having to pay 60 or 80 quid to get into these things, but you really, in my opinion, you could really have spent all of your time in the Avalon Rising area and found so many different things to do. In the meantime, we'll play, as I say, a couple of tunes. The first one returns to the general sleepwalking and when the man comes around theme, and is from Taboo, and it tells us just exactly what it is that the man is after when he comes around.
Where am I? In the village. What do you want? Information. Whose side are you on? That would be telling. We want information. Information. Who is number one? In the village. In the village. In the village.
Has anyone ever escaped?
Gonna drop my guard. I ain't gonna lose my rights. She's all the times are hard. No dibs dodging
hear about that man who said it couldn't happen here. I sang this song to warn him, but he didn't want to hear. Said DNA is the price I'll pay for living with no fear. Then when he got home, he met his clone with a grin from ear to ear. I ain't gonna drop my guard. I ain't gonna lose my rights. Although the times are hard, don't give a damn what you think I'm worth. I have the right to what was left. Ain't gonna take that bastard master. Don't wanna use that bastard master. Ain't gonna take that bastard master.
That was Seize the Day with Bastard MasterCard, outlining some of the aspects of the administration. And before that was Prisoner Number 6, the Prisoner theme. I think it was done by Taboo and is available for listening to on YouTube. What do you want information? Too right. I just do not know how that man managed to slip that whole series, the Prisoner, past whatever controlling entities they were. He must have been pretty clever, because clearly the kind of stuff that we talk about now, he knew about way back then in, I guess, the late 60s or early 70s. Anybody who's not seen The Prisoner, it also is available in its entirety on YouTube and is most informative as well as most entertaining. Questions, remember, are a burden to others. So Seize the Day, of course, we're playing at the Green Gathering, and we heard some of their stuff last week. We heard, I forgot to credit them actually for No DSS, which was the second tune I played by them. We also played Don't Do ID, both of which are off their new album, Standing Strong. Very interesting songs, some of those. So let's have a quick spin through some of these photographs. I put the link up in the chat room, internetradio.drrock.biz/download/green.gathering.2014, which is a PDF and gives you a chance to see where we were and what we were doing. This one was incredibly hard work, running four venues and the Fairy Glen and getting it all set up. The first slide is called number one, because I've finally got the got the hang of the numbering system, and the view of the festival market and the bridge, because the site is within sight of the old bridge over from Wales to England, which I always think is a really nice, it's like some kind of metaphor, isn't it, really? The market area is an amazing place. There's food there. There's also various bizarre clothes and things. We never really have any what do we call it? Discretionary spending when we're at these places. Also, if you can see the picture, there's lots and lots of children running around. That is something that I really like about all the festivals I choose to go to, and the Green Gathering is no exception. And when we were listening to Tamash the other week, we could hear the children make a damn sight more noise than a dance tent. That's all I can say. Sometimes it's really difficult to talk above them. And they're everywhere on the Green Gathering site, and of course they can pretty much run around with their mates and things and know that it's all completely safe. Having said that, there was a pretty bizarre incident involving one of our crew where, once again, Facebook turned out to be a bit of a menace as far as the police's relationship with it goes, in that one of the crew members, her daughter, is on Facebook, and her mates decided to set about a rumour that she'd been kidnapped, when in fact she was at the Green Gathering with her mum. And the result of that was that there was a mobile phone call to the lady concerned, saying that she was required to go down to the main gate for a person check, and to take her daughter with her to prove that her daughter was all right. And if she didn't come down there, then the police were going to come onto the site and have a look. Well, I'm sure we could have come up to responses with some responses for that one, couldn't we? The Green Gathering site itself is a big site. It's a big and beautiful site. There's a kind of quiet bit where we are, Avalon Rising, and where the children's entertainment area is. We have a stone circle in front of Avalon Rising as well. As you move up from there, you get the market area where you can get the food, and if you've got any meaningless promissory tokens to dispose of, then you can swap them for stuff. There's a campaigns area which I've been into probably two or three times. Didn't go in there at all this year, although there were people in there that I would have liked to have talked to if I'd had the chance. There's a crafts area where they're showing how to make rocket stoves and Viking knives and basket making and clothes repairing and stuff. And one of the little areas is a teepee village, which slide two shows. It's that you can see the big woodlands that Fred goes foraging in the background there. And the teepees are all, I think most of them are available for hire. So you can kind of go in there again in exchange for some gaming tokens and spend your night in some kind of traditional and other landly kind of place. Very beautiful down there, though. And like I say, the woods are amazing because you've got free rein through those whilst you're at the festival. In fact, there is actually a public footpath through the Green Gathering, just in case anybody should be interested in that piece of information. Slide three shows a windmill. I love this. I love the kind of human ingenuity. There's a fair amount of it at the Green Gathering, even more if you manage to get your way into the Off-Grid Festival, which has got, it's like your cruise festival, the Off-Grid. There's all manner of things going on there. Everybody who's there is turning out something useful and endeavouring to show other people how to do it, which is what we like. Slide four shows the machine that the windmill is driving. There's a kind of big flywheel at the back, which is green and red, and then at the front there's some kind of power takeoff, which presumably they can use for things. It's a truly amazing looking piece of gear. Slide five shows a view across the field to the main stage, which is the little blue kind of tent type thing, which is sitting just to the right of the house. And it's a long way away from everything else that's going on, which I think is a pretty good idea. You can sort of vaguely hear what's going on over there. Mostly the music gets mixed in amongst the festivals, and so everything else has to compete with it. The house itself is an incredible old hulk. I find it. Yeah, even when it's got all the shining lights shone on the front of it, maybe even especially then, it is quite a menacing looking place. And there's some sort of quite sizable mausoleum just to the left of it, and barely 50 yards away. Everything about it, frankly, gives me the willies. You can see a huge bank of solar panels. One of the advantages of the Green Gathering is that there are no generators. All of the power is developed by solar, although they haven't yet found a way of working their way around having propane on site, which gives some purists a bit of a problem. Personally, I like my food, and if you're going to be doing all that stuff, you do need to keep yourself well fed. Slide six shows the main stage with Seize the Day on it. Once again, I like that shot because if you look at the very front of the stage, rather than being a kind of press of grown-ups and all that, and they're very popular, Seize the Day, there's lots and lots of children sitting there listening. I think that's absolutely marvellous because the children, as hopefully one day we manage to cover in the show, because it is a subject I'd like to look at, are perhaps the key to the challenges that we're facing. Many of them appear to be arriving here downloaded with quite astonishing information and nous. I don't know whether any of you have seen on YouTube, there's a 13-year-old Turkish boy taking a media interviewer apart. It's all in, all in subtitles. Otherwise, I'd have played it to you, but it's well worth going and looking for. 13-year-old Turkish boy on YouTube showing just how much more he knows than the grown-up, and the grown-up is pretty astonished. And so probably asleep. Slide seven shows two of the Avalon Rising domes. It shows the red and yellow striped marquee is the main talk space. And the one that's kind of turquoise and pink and green and white to the left of it is the Stars and Stones dome. In between, although you can barely see it under the awning and the Avalon Rising shop where our various artists exhibit and try and sell their prints and cards and things like that. That is Mr. Electric's bus. That is what was powering the Stars and Stones dome. And it's where Dr. Rock's radio show came from when it was coming live from the Green Gathering. Absolutely luxurious in there as well. They've got a settee and a chair and lots and lots of batteries, lots of solar power. It was able to charge up all our phones and laptops and things for the duration. Not something, frankly, that I used to have to do, but by and large, things have become so busy now that one way or the other, I no longer get the luxury of offline time, or at least not without the sacrifice of having to spend like a day and a half catching up with my own arse. In the background of that picture as well, you can see the great old oak tree, which forms very much a centrepiece of the Avalon Rising encampment there, because as well as our tents out in the wilds there with the stone circle in front of it, we've got an area behind called the Fairy Glen, which we will see in a bit. Number 8 shows a slightly closer up image of Avalon Rising, and the reason why I like that shot is you can see some guys sitting on the ground having a chat. There's people standing around talking. There's lots of people in that shot. There's a stone circle there, which Sean Kirwan, our kind of site manager, coordinator and general team runner, sets up. We like to leave it there if we can, but every now and then, because of the demands of Chepstow Racecourse, it is necessary to remove it and then bring it back from wherever it's been stashed and put it back again. You'll remember that Steve Jaross, one of the team members at Avalon Rising, is particularly strong on stone circles, as is Sean himself, indeed. Number 9 shows a view inside Avalon Rising. It's actually quite a big space. I don't know who was on when this photograph was taken. There's not too many people in there. One of the beauties of talking at somewhere like this, at the Green Gathering or at a festival, is that people can come to the door, come to the doorway to the tent, and they can see what's going on and they can move in. Which is what tends to happen. Sometimes this tent is absolutely packed. I mean, we had in the main arena, we had Sean himself doing lots of dowsing work. And I know there's many people out there who have their doubts about dowsing. But when you encounter people like Noel Squibb, who's been on the show, and Steve Jaross, who's been on the show, and Sean, who's been on the show, and you actually see them using these techniques, you realise that you are dealing with something quite uncanny. You can find the interviews with Steve Jaross and Noel and the rest of them on Dr. Rock's podcast page, which can be got at from peoplesinternetradio.com. So Sean did several workshops over the days. We had a lady called Louise doing an Art of Sacred Geometry talk. And she was absolutely amazing. It was the first time she'd done a talk, and she had some really, really interesting information on how important sacred geometry is. I'm just going to see if I can find a link to her website. Yes, I can. Here we go. I'll try and put that in the podcast. I was continuing to talk, in the chat room. There we go. The artofsacredgeometry.com, all one word. And the next thing we're going to see in the slideshow, in fact, is the next 4 slides. If you look around the inside of the Avalon Rising tent in slide 9, you can see several of these works of art actually hanging on the wall there. I guess they must be, I don't know, they're 5 foot tall, each of these things, and there were at least 24 of them in there. I took photographs of all of them, and all the photos look really good, but they don't really do justice to the original works. So pictures 10 through to about 13, I think, are just examples of Louise's geometry artwork. Sorry, I'm just being bewitched by it as I look at it. So that's 10, 11 and 12. Number 12 is really beautiful. She does the Flower of Life. Many of you will be familiar with that. And all of these designs are based on the Flower of Life. She's learnt how to do all sorts of tricks with it that can turn it into flames and phoenixes and angels and all manner of things. And then she's obviously got a really hearty set of acrylics. I particularly like number 13, which is called Vector, because it shows the relationship between all the platonic forms, the Flower of Life, and your basic Borg-like cube down at the bottom. And it's based on a thing called vector equilibrium. So I found that Louise's talk in the end reaches the same kind of point as mine does. We're very interested in the shape of the cube octahedron, which is a marriage of the representations of earth and air. And really is, when you get down to it, it's the shape of the matrix. Louise reaches that point from a completely different direction from the way I do, which is one of the things I really liked about listening to her. I can't wait to see Louise talk when she's had a little bit of practice, because I think she's a real showstopper myself, as is her artwork. And she obviously, because She's now learnt how to use Photoshop. She's managed to put together all of the slides for her show as works of art as well. Completely astonishing. Perhaps she'll be on the show at some point when she's feeling a bit more courageous. And track picture 14 shows, just says power, and it's got a green lorry and a whole rake of solar panels, and that was what we were using to run Avalon Rising in the early days when I was doing Out of the Ordinary Festival and Sunrise and various others, which have either collapsed or been abandoned by the Doctor for one reason or another. We used to run out of power quite a lot and find ourselves, if we were in a late night slot particularly, having to do our talks without slides, which is really interesting if you're planning on doing them with them. So that was the power. Phil's bus was powering the Stars and Stones Dome, and this little thing shown in picture 14 was running the Avalon Rising tent. Actually, it's these projectors. They take an enormous amount of power to project images against the screen if you've got sunlight outside the tent. So that's basically where all of that power was going, as far as I can tell, although we did have plenty of lights about the place as well. Number 15 shows the Stars and Stones Dome, which is run by the Auriga Mystery School, who I also get the opportunity of working with occasionally. And in there we had Fred Gillam doing his wild food and foraging talk and a walk at the very beginning. We had fairy making for kids. We had the Flower of Life for kids, which I think was run by Louise. We had Songs from the Heart and Chants, which I know went down really well. Perpetual Choirs. Superfood Conscious Nutrition, Earth's Vibrational Essences, Spiritual Economics, an open source blueprint from John Witterick. We had Tamash, who was on the other day talking about living in shamanic community, and he was talking about esoteric Christianity, one that I would have personally liked to have got to, because it is a very interesting subject. We had Magical Passes and Tensegrity. We had The Consciousness of Space, Your Journey with Your Home, Plant Spirit Medicine from Fred Gillam. We had Tim Wheater, who's been on the show, doing his Music for the Heart. We had Awakening the Laughing Buddha Within. There's quite a lot of interesting laughing workshops going on nowadays. Some geezer called Dr. Rock did Worlds in Collision and The Electric Universe. We had Sean was doing Dowsing for Kids. I'm not sure whether no need to douse for kids at the Green Gathering, but I think it means something else. Earth Acupuncture, The Five Wisdoms of Taoist Tradition, space Clearing with Sound, Spiritual Protection. One of People's Internet Radio's favourite, Dave Murphy, was in there talking about urine therapy, which he does at the drop of a hat, it has to be said. So that was the Stars and Stones Dome. Quite a lot of stuff going on in there. We'll just have a quick look at the Avalon Rising as well, because that also had some interesting stuff. We had Julie Rocker running a walking meditation. She was on the show last year talking about water. There's a lady called Gail Eaton, who is an amazing character, and she was offering the Lower World Shamanic Journey. Now, again, shamanic journey sounds like a pretty strange idea. It certainly did to me when I first encountered it. And I do have to say that, especially when it's done in a group context and you can actually share the results of it together, then it really is. There is obviously, I think, something going on there. Shamanic journeying, if you get the chance to do it. And again, of course, at the Green Gathering, you pay to get in. So all of this stuff you can just get at as you want to. Free Energy and Ether Physics from Nolan Thacker, who was on the show live from the show itself. Tim Wheater was in there doing a sonic tone. I guess talking about the detuning of all of our scales. Intimate Relationship as a Radical Path to Self-Realization. Once again, to many people, that sounds like a really bizarre subject, but anybody that listened to Annie Day on a Dr. Rock show a few weeks back, who's one of our main drives at the moment is spiritual and sexual healing. I think she and Jules Wingfield, who gave this self-realization talk, would have really hit it off. We had Hugh Newman, who's one of the founders of Avalon Rising. He was talking about mounds, megaliths and giants, and who really built the ancient sites. Tamash doing his shamanic community living. We had Serena Roney-Dougal, another old hand on the Dr. Rock show, when she was on with us, she was talking about psi research, which is what she's been doing with her adult life, shall we say, for want of a better phrase. She this time talked about exploring consciousness, an east-west perspective. I got a recording of that talk as well, and hope at some point to be able to play parts of that. And Serena's already agreed to come on the show at some point and talk quantum physics with us. That's something I've been meaning to do for 3 years whilst I've been doing this show, is exploring where science has got to with the nature of the reality that we appear to be dwelling in, inhabiting, whatever the word is. So she's agreed to come on and talk about that and her great love of fairy lore and how important that is. We had Karma Singh talking about the Kingdom of Germany and how they're endeavouring to replace the system over there. That is a very interesting subject. And Karma's also due to come on the show in the next couple of weeks and take us through what it is they're trying to do over there. And we have English language links to their constitution, which I know will be of interest to the people in the chat box at People's Internet Radio, because many of them know a thing or two about constitutions. We had Hugh Newman again, Earth Grids and the Enchantment of the Landscape. And at the end of Saturday night, we had Ian Crane, and he gets a double slot on Saturday night. I'm quite interested by Ian's stuff. I think he's doing a very, very important job alerting people to the fact that there is a rabbit hole there. He was talking about the fractured future, about fracking, and about Agenda 21. Agenda 21 is, I think, a subject that's well worth covering with people, because once again, amongst the uninformed, most people have never even heard of it. And even many of those who are actually working towards it don't actually know what it is. Every morning started in Avalon Rising with a bit of gentle yoga, if you wanted that sort of thing. Steve Jaross was on again, actually demonstrating using his dowsing rods where the telluric currents were in the tent and showing how you could move them around by pushing rocks over them. That was really quite astonishing. Jonathan Kaner, famous astrologer and a really good talker. I've got one of his talks somewhere, but we never got around to playing it. He was talking about the seven greatest secrets of the universe. I missed that as well. Lucy Wyatt, she's been on the show. She was talking about the blueprint for civilization. Nolan Thacker again talking about conscious community living. So that was what was going on in Avalon Rising. And so you can hopefully get, the reason I'm going through this is hopefully to give you some sort of idea of just exactly how much variety there is in these particular arenas. When I first got with them, there was a lot more of the lawful and legal stuff. And but I guess personally, I'd like to see a bit more of that come back, because a lot of progress is being made. And there are some very, very interesting first-hand experiences that can be talked about there. So that's Avalon Rising, the Stars and Stones. Picture 16 shows inside the Stars and Stones dome. There's Synchro making a rare appearance on the camera and looking for all the world like a presenter there, but she is in fact being audience. And that's Fred Gillam. You can see this is a really light space. It's a pretty fabulous geodesic dome, and there's more of Louise's artwork hanging up on the roof there. As you can probably tell, when Fred was in there doing his mushrooms talk, that place was really pretty full. Number 17 shows the entrance to the Fairy Glen. This is something that Steve Jaross built. Unfortunately, a lot of destruction had been wreaked in the week before we got there. We've been building in this place for about 3 years or so, putting in benches around the trees and making things that we can use and decorate next year, hopefully enabling us to kind of move forwards. But a lot of it had been destroyed this time and burnt. And this entrance was one of the things that suffered. You can actually see there's a lovely little crystal ball there, which was fabulous the way it picked up the lights and the trees and everything. You can also see Mr. Electric Phil's lights there glowing, even though it's daylight. Very, very bright LEDs, and he could change the colour on them by using his iPhone. And in the background there, at the back right of the picture, you can see the big and ancient oak tree. It's probably been there for many, many hundreds of years. And I suspect that isolated examples of them can probably live into four figures, you know, 1,000 years or so. And it's said that all the creatures that are living on that oak tree are descendants of the well, many of them are descendants of the creatures that were on there when it was a sapling. Really amazing idea. I built a bit of a labyrinth around that that we get to see later. Picture 18 shows the entrance to the Fairy Glen seen from the front. You can still see the blue lights there and the little sign asking how many elementals can you spot, because there's some nice clay at this site. And part of the crew spend 3 or 4 days making little fairies and elemental spirits representations of and things. And the idea is that children and grown-ups, of course, can go in there and see how many of them they can spot. And to the left of the entrance to the Fairy Glen there, you see some little shabby things that you can't see too clearly. So picture 19 shows Shane's elder flowers. And this was a stunt that he learnt off a gypsy many years ago, was how to make these incredibly flowery looking flowers out of elder sticks. And he kind of he draws the stick against a knife that's held close against his knee. And these flowers emerge, and it kind of looks sort of easy when Shane's doing it, but many people had a go and it's not so easy as it appears. The other thing is that they might appear to be just fripperies, but Shane actually made he was making them right up to the last minute when he went away, because he was he'd been swapping them for pizzas and beer and all that kind of stuff. So these, for Shane, were a kind of currency. Really great alternative currency. Picture 20 shows the nighttime entrance to the Fairy Glen. So that's what Mr. Electric's lights look like at night. We'll see one or two more of those. And picture 21 shows the same lights when you're actually lying underneath them, because I thought, oh, they're ever so pretty. Could save you an awful lot of money in entheogens, lights like that. They really could. Picture 22 shows what the Fairy Glen was like when we arrived on the Sunday. The thing opened on the Thursday lunchtime, and this was really, really a hideous mess. You get a bit of a detail on picture number 23 that says evidence of a smashing time. Not just smashing. I mean, these bottles were actually melted together in the fireplace. I think they'd used the oak star that we used to use build the Fairy Glen round the sort of centrepiece to make a fire, and oak of that kind of size and age can make it really hot. And it wasn't just in the fireplace. It was like the whole place was covered in broken glass. We were picking it out of there for 3-4 days, right up to the last minute. And bottle bottoms had been smashed and bottle tops, and they don't smash easy. And it was all in the bracken all the way around the Fairy Glen. And it was a bit of a shock to some of the team. Obviously, there had been a whole lot of people there. You can see from picture number 22. That they'd had several fires around the place and that they'd not taken anything with them at all. And even once the festival was going, I was finding broken glass in various nether regions. Number 24 is a distant view of the centrepiece. A lot of people spend a lot of time using natural and some man-made materials and things to make a place which is just fascinating for children and for grown-ups. You can see in the background of that picture that there's a large cedar tree, another venerable old tree. And hanging up in front of it is a sort of top left of the picture is a thing that looks like butterfly wings. And it is, in fact, a pair of swan's wings that have been made into a bit of decor. A lot of these people are into critter bits of one sort or another and make everything from incense wafting tools to things that are just nice to look at. And you should have felt the weight of the swan's wings. They were really big, and they weighed nothing really. I'm told that the lightest wings, and I haven't felt one yet, are from an owl. We have got Synchro's got a pair of buzzard's wings though, and they're really light too. Number 25 shows a little bit of detail of the Fairy Glen centrepiece. The little spots that you can see, they're all pine cones, which of course themselves are perfect geometric representations of the Fibonacci sequence. You can see a kind of elemental sort of demon type thing peering out there, and lots of little mushrooms. It's a beautiful and fascinating place. Another of the fireplaces is shown, the X fireplaces, is shown in picture number 26, which shows a yin and yang sign that was built there. I'd have personally love to have seen baby yin and yangs in the dots the other way around. And there's also a bench in the background there. Another part of the team spent quite a lot of time building greenwood benches whilst they had the time, because they're quite time consuming. And then as the gig got closer, they started building more rudimentary benches, but all of it designed to give people places to sit around the Avalon Rising Arena and take the air and enjoy the company, something that many of us don't get a chance to do in everyday life, let alone building green furniture. Picture 27 shows Mr. Electric's lights making making one archway into the glen. My camera, or me actually, more accurately, I don't know enough about the camera, wasn't good enough to photograph what the place looks like at night when it's lit by hundreds of night lights, which for some reason, which defeats me, actually burn in paper bags without setting fire to the paper bag. There's a little bit of sand in the bottom, a nightlight standing on it. And so the whole place has got these little glowing lanterns around it, and it's perhaps even more lovely at night than it is during the day. Also, through the main archway there, which is coloured in green with lots of greenery hanging off it, you can see another little archway, which goes to picture 28, the Nature Dome. It calls it a fairy venue because it was one of the places where some of the smaller gigs were happening. We had walking a journey to Lou there, which is a storytelling, a cross between storytelling and shamanic journeying, really. Temash was in there talking about shamanic paths. Lisa Goodwin was in there talking living mythology, how stories build our personal culture. I'm sure all of you out there can imagine how useful a talk that was. There was some healing amulet making. Matthew Hopwood was in there talking about his English love stories. And Jess was in there doing the tale of Taliesin that we heard on the show last week. There's nature meditation. Natasha, who we heard with Fred there, Fred's partner, working partner, did an intro to shamanic journeying. Lisa Goodwin was doing Tales from the White Spring, which is a really amazing place in Glastonbury. If you ever go there, really try and escape from the entirely commercial high street and stuff and go and have a look at the White Spring. It's got a hell of a feel to it and a hell of a history. More gentle laughing mindfulness, songs from the Room of Gaia and some... that's the resonant intent, that is. I got it wrong. There was a hand fasting in there. I did have a photograph of the people that were hand fasted, but that somehow didn't make the mix. And this was also where Fred was due to do his medicinal mushrooms talk, but thankfully it got moved to a bigger venue. And Tomash was doing Arthurian mysteries. So you can probably get the idea as well now that the crew at Avalon Rising are pretty varied, because as well as building this place, they do all of these different subjects. And all of them are fascinating. I think we get kind of an hour or an hour and a half each, maybe including questions. On the other side of the Fairy Glen, we had the Resonant Intent, which is a bit of a pun. And you've already heard some of that because I got it confused with the Nature Dome. Number 30 shows the Avalon Rising crew dining room and kitchen. The kitchen is the wee tent at the end. The dining room is the bit at the front. And we've got two of the core kitchen crew members there. We had six of us this year, which was really great because otherwise the kitchen can be very hairy. That's Oki and Synchro again, off Synchro in the middle. And then Young, the lady who I met up at Old Chapel Farm, who came along to the Green Gathering and you could tell by her face, she'd had such a great time there. 31 shows the old oak, and you can just about make out on the floor a seven-coil labyrinth, which was made out of driftwood and things that's kind of garnered from the woodlands around. We built it last year and had to travel a fair way with, you would not believe how much dry wood you need to build a seven-coil labyrinth. It is a very, very long line indeed. And again, a lot of it had gone missing. Some of it had been burnt. Much of it had been kicked around. Fortunately, only a week or so earlier, which meant that we could still see in the grass. The grass had grown where the sticks hadn't been, like, so we could still see where it was. But we did have to, I know because I did a fair bit of this, we did have to walk a fair way to get enough wood to put it back in place. But it's a very popular feature. People really like it. Lots of people walk the labyrinth. And I think the oak tree probably appreciates it as well. And you can see that there's a bench for people to sit on built around the oak, which, again, we did build last year. It was built by the team last year and had to be replaced this year again. And here's a bit of three-dimensional Louise art. It's a tin foil covered vector equilibrium. So it's the cube octahedron made up of the four squares that make up a cube and the eight triangles that make up an octahedron married together with radii, if that's the right word, going to the center. Very shiny thing that was and quite big, revolving in the oak tree there. See a few people around the oak tree having done the labyrinth. Picture 33 shows what the spooky old oak looked like at night, as lit by Mr. Electric's lights. There's a red arch into that one, although it was a different colour each night. And you can see the tree. It looks kind of blurry, but when you look carefully, you can see the oak tree all built in, all kind of floodlit in green. And also there were lights around the labyrinth as well. And picture number 34, because I didn't feel safe leaving at 33, is some of the crew from Avalon Rising. And what we did was this was the Monday lunchtime, so easily half of us had gone home. This is the half that stayed behind to tat down, as the phrase go. And what we decided to do was we decided that we'd all walk the labyrinth. And the thing about walking labyrinths, a seven coiler, is that you get to do a high five on the right side and the left side with everybody who's coming into the labyrinth twice as you're going into the middle. So it was a really good meditation for the crew. It was a good team building exercise to be doing right at the end of it. And you have to really concentrate, because at some points with that many people walking into the labyrinth, you were high-fiving two people at once, one on one side and one on the other. I'm just going to see if we can, here we go. Mr. Electric, Phil Clegg, actually put together a YouTube video of that occurring. So I'll just post that into the chat box. It's up on YouTube. If you put in Avalon Rising 2014, I think you'll probably come across it. And it's got some amusing music, and it shows the whole of the crew moving into there to form up that last photograph. So pretty rapid little run through all of that for you. We're building up now to hearing a bit more of Fred Gillam, because I can see the time is slipping away. But before we do that, give you a quick rest and play another couple of tunes. This one, the first one, is called Letters to Mr. Bush. I played three tunes from Tracy Curtis last week. She's a lovely songster, really great voice, and an acoustic guitar. But most of all, she's really great with the lyrics, and I think you're going to be hearing a lot from her. And that's going to be followed by another Seize the Day tune, because they were at the Green Gathering, as I said, and they're doing a song called All Coppers. Which is basically, I think, a fair attempt at explaining how difficult it is to be a copper, something that we do encourage taking on board here at People's Internet Radio, because they are just men and women trying to put food on the table, just like the rest of us. And I think it's quite a nice outline in music. So much of what we need to hear is actually in the music. So, first of all, Letters to Mr. Bush from Tracy Curtis. Seize the Day there with All Coppers, an unusually sympathetic take, I thought. And before that, Tracy Curtis. See, the chat box has been a little bit active whilst I've been chattering away about my pictures. The captain, always one for the comment, how come any pictures you post of your events, they're always full of bloody long-haired hippies? Well, that's what they're like, Ray, honestly. And actually, you can just pass the time sitting in the sunshine watching all of the adequately proportioned people wandering around the place. And I do swear sometimes it's like Life of Brian there. There must be somebody on the gate selling beards or something. Again, especially true that one is of the off-grid festival, where I think every single bloke in the place has got a beard, as far as I can remember. And Ray, once again, always one for the PC comment, says there is an unsightly fat person there, though. Well, you know, there you go. Got to have a bit of variety, mate. Rick's put in that even the Green Party members don't know what Agenda 21 is. I remember when I first came across Agenda 21, we were doing a bit of auditing work, gathering together a list of books that were available from a charity that was based in a local town. And they were responsible, I think, for moving material into schools and other educational outlets of one sort or another. And they had a whole load of documentation there, which was really vapid. It kind of did the same thing as newspapers. When you're kind of reading it, you think there's sort of nothing here. And they all referred to, all of these documents referred to a single glossy brochure, which was obviously the source of and at the heart of them all. And it turned out to be a really buffed up kind of shine, nice and shiny kind of PDF styly sort of thing with not very many words and a lot of really pictures which you could easily sympathise with. And it was some sort of core document for Agenda 21. At the time, I hadn't heard of Agenda 21. And I really wish to God I'd kept one of those now, because I'd be very interested now to see what's in it. But the charity, of course, as is always the case, of these little things has had its funding withdrawn. It's been turned into something else and everything's been redistributed. And yes, Captain, the big house is derelict. It's just like a toothless maw gaping out over the festival. And thanks, Jimmy, about the Benny Hill theme to go with the vid of the Avalon Rising crew in the labyrinth. I tend to agree with you there. It was great fun doing that. So looks like we're going to be running a little bit over tonight, because what I want to do before the last two couple of play-out tunes is just give a bit of a teaser for next week's show, as we hear 15 minutes or so of Fred, who was speaking earlier about the medicinal mushrooms, talking about plant spirit medicine, because I think that's probably mostly what we're going to be talking about, is because I think he covered the mushrooms pretty well there. Obviously, we can take questions on them and stuff, but he's as informed about what we can use all the other plants that are around us for as well. So here's Fred Gillam in his second bite of the cherry for tonight, talking about plant spirit medicine, recorded at the Avalon Rising Arena at this year's Green Gathering. And you are, of course, listening to Dr. Rock's radio show on peoplesinternetradio.com, where we are seeking all sorts of solutions. Ladies and gentlemen, here's Fred.
So it doesn't really refer to the use of plants that are mind-altering purely for recreational purposes. It's not really about getting high. Okay, the term entheogen kind of is removed from that. It's not really about doing it just for pleasure. Okay? And there are an awful lot of books that have come out. There have been loads of TV documentaries, all kinds of stuff over the internet that talk about how indigenous cultures use strong, powerful, mind-altering plants in order to attain altered states of consciousness, whereby they may seek healing experiences for themselves or for other people, and often in the hands of an experienced practitioner who has inherited a traditional body of knowledge that instructs them how to work with these plants. And very often, probably actually 100% of the time, in that setting, the plants are viewed, in my opinion, as they should be, as sentient living beings with consciousness, just like every other part of creation is, in my opinion. So in an indigenous worldview, no matter where you are in the world, you will find the common held belief that everything has life. Everything has life, has spirit, has the ability to animate forces and, in a sense, to do work, to accomplish things. Okay? So we live in a conscious, sentient world that is every bit as aware of what is around, you know, what's around it as we are, every single part of it, every stone, rock, blade of grass, drop of water has consciousness. Okay? So that's the worldview I think that plant spirit medicine comes from. And I think that's the common point between what I'm going to talk about today and something else that's really going on a lot now, which is spiritual tourism, I would call it, where people are actually going off to visit indigenous elders of different cultures, tribes, traditions, etc., and taking as a sacrament the traditional plants of those cultures and having experiences that they are bringing back into this culture. Has anyone done that? Has anyone been on an ayahuasca journey in a foreign country? Has anyone seen an ayahuasca in, I don't know, somewhere in South America? Or perhaps even somebody saying that they are one here, and someone used ayahuasca in this way?
Yeah.
Yeah? So, hands up if you have. Okay. Right. I haven't, by the way. I was just an example of what hands up.
I went to Mexico in 90, working with another plant spirit.
Okay. So, I suppose it's a good place to begin this talk because, really, this is all very topical and all very popular at the moment. I mean, I was at a festival in May this year where I reckon, you know, a really, really large percentage of the people at this festival had actually taken ayahuasca at the festival. Okay? And my jury's really out as to whether that's appropriate behaviour. Yeah? Personally. I saw a lot of people in chaotic headspaces, a lot of confusion, a lot of people having to have therapy in various guises in order to get through their ayahuasca experience. But that wasn't being offered by the person dishing it out particularly, because there were lots and lots of people and they couldn't have possibly helped all of those people. And I think what I want to talk about here a little bit is responsibility. Okay? Mind-altering plants are, in the wrong hands or approached with the wrong frame of mind, incredibly dangerous. Not only to yourself, to your bodily well-being and to your mind, but also to those around you if they have to deal with you having a bad experience. Okay? And I have known people using entheogens inappropriately who've pretty much had breakdowns. They pretty much disassembled themselves, which can be part of the shamanic work that we can do with these plant spirits, but they've actually had no idea about how to put themselves back together again and no one to show them how to do it. And it's rumbled on for 6 months, 12 months, 18 months with this person continually going in and out of a state of crisis and everybody around them not knowing what to do. Because we don't live in a culture where we know how to support those experiences. We just don't. You know, and who would you go and see? You know, if that was going on for you. If you go and see a mental health practitioner, you'll end up on medication and section. You know, if you go and see your GP, probably the end result will be roughly the same.
You go and see somebody who's had quite a bit of experience in that field to talk to them about it.
Yeah, if you can find somebody. Yeah. I think in the culture that we have, in this mini culture that we have here, it's probably not too hard to do. Yeah? I think out there in the mainstream, it's actually pretty difficult to do. There's just not much of it about, is there?
We have our own, you're probably going to go there, but we have our own native entheogens as well.
We do. We have lots of native entheogens, yeah. Loads of them.
Yeah.
Yeah. But really, that's my next point. So, There's a really great saying that somebody once said to me, that, and they said, either everything is magic or nothing is magic. Okay? Now, that is completely alien to our Western worldview. So, what they were kind of getting at was that, you know, there is this so-called mundane world, you know, here's the carpet, here's the grass, here's the table. And then there's this other stuff that some people think doesn't exist at all, and then some people are very clear that it does exist, but there's really no objective proof for it, and in some way people call that spiritual, supernatural, whatever it is, you know, and there's this debate about even if it's real among some people, and then there's this debate among other people about which bits of it are good for you, and all this stuff, but that's not the worldview that the use of entheogens comes from, okay? The use of entheogens, the use of plant spirit, I don't want to use the word use, working with plant spirits does not come from that worldview. It's not about doing something that takes you away from mundane reality. Everything is magic. Either nothing is magic or everything is magic, okay? So this is a miracle of creation, this carpet. It's got whole worlds within its molecular structure. It has energy. It's felt the footsteps of everybody who ever trod across it. There is no such thing as mundane reality or anything at all, for that matter, that is supernatural. There is nothing supernatural. Everything is natural. And everything is part of a whole creation, a holistic creation. And that's the worldview that working with plant spirits comes out of. Okay, so there's no point trying to go somewhere else. It's all about learning about, in a deeper way, what we already have. It's what we hold. We have what we hold. So this talk, and we're going to do a walk, and we're going to do some exercises if you care to join in with me, is not about, it's not about escapism, it's not about people getting off their heads. We're not going to use any sort of powerful, chemically mind-altering plants, but I'm going to explain what I mean by that anyway in a moment. And I just want to say for the record, I actually personally believe that the bringing of the ayahuasca culture here to the West is a really damaging thing. I actually think it's bad. I'm really down on it. So if anyone wants to talk with me about that later, please go ahead, because I just think it's ridiculous and I think it's really bad. My
not
partner...
All of them.
Sorry? I'll explain why I'm saying this. I don't believe there's any such thing as a bad plant.
Yeah.
It's nothing to do with the plant. But I will explain more about this, you know. But there's a good example that you came up with, Ash, though, about the marijuana. My partner had some ayahuasca staying at her place for several weeks, who came over from South America, and they were conducting a ceremony at one point there. And she said that she didn't actually want to partake of the yahe. And this conversation ensued the following day about why that happened. And he said, I don't understand what's going on. He said, where I come from, back home, there are droves of people, white people, who are nothing to do with the culture that I grew up in, turning up and saying they want to take yahe. And there are loads of people from the villages and towns claiming that they are shaman, claiming that they are ayahuasqueros, and claiming to teach these people and taking bucks for it. He said, and they're not. It is just tourism. And these people are putting themselves in a lot of danger. And he cited plenty of examples of people he knew who, yeah, they had taken yahe quite a few times in their life because it was a culturally normal thing to do. But they certainly hadn't been brought up in the tradition of how to use it as a healing medicine and how to teach other people how to use it. They weren't carrying that knowledge, but they were actually taking in Western visitors, literally taking them in, taking their money and giving them ayahuasca. And that seems to be the most common thing that happens, more so than people... I mean, you can have a genuine experience because you've had an experience. There are a lot of people being taken in. And the same guy also said, I mean, he was one of a party that of elders that came over. One of them was, I think, 110 years old. They came over to stay. And one of the other things he said was, I don't get you people. He said, one of the people who came to my village gave me some marijuana. He said, it blew my head off. I was seeing all the trees were turning into serpents. He said, I don't understand why you don't use it that way. He said, I was terrified. Give me yahe any day. It's really powerful stuff you've got over there. And then he said, and what about the mushrooms? What, you know, why are you all coming here? Why? He said, you're ignoring the spirit of your own land to pay people money and come here. And he said, that's wrong. Okay, and I agree with that man. So if you are on a genuine search and you want to work with the world of plant spirits, they're here all around you, everywhere, absolutely everywhere, screaming out, come and work with me, I will teach you. They're here. There is nothing particularly special about the plants that grow in South America, in the sense that they're not more special than the plants that grow here. They're not more powerful than the plants that grow here. But the plants that grow here do embody the energy of this place. Okay? If you want answers about how to live here in harmony with the earth, then work with the plants that grow here and struggle and are actually tortured by the farming practices that, you know, that we carry out here, and that are struggling for existence in this soil. Just on a most common sense level, who's grown their own potatoes? Yeah? Great. So when you eat potatoes that you dig in your own garden, they taste better, right?
Yeah.
Yeah? Universally, right. I completely agree. And everybody's potatoes taste different, and it's not down to the variety, it is partly down to the variety, but if you plant the same variety in someone else's garden, it will taste different. Okay? Because what you're really tasting is the soil. Okay? Those plants have taken nutrients from that soil where they are growing. They've absorbed the energy fields of the earth there. The beating heart of Mother Earth has instructed them in their life cycle. They have responded to the hours of daylight, the seasons, you know, all of the strange weather patterns that we have. And there's a unique mineral content and makeup in that place. Not to mention the fungal kingdom that it will be interacting with, exchanging nutrients with across mycelial networks. Everyone's potatoes are different, right? Just the same as we're all human beings, but you're different to you, you're different to you, you're different to you. We are all individually different. As well as we're all the same, we are also all different. And so, if you want to find out, for example, something about a particular place, you want to find out how to work with the soil in a particular place, would it not be the logical step to ask the plants that grow in that soil and communicate with them to try and understand how it is they are growing? Okay? One of the things I do when I go to a place, I find the plant that tastes most strongly and clearly of the earth where it grows in this country, in southern England, is the stinging nettle. So I will eat raw stinging nettle when I go to a place. Because just by biting into it, the juices that run out taste completely different from site to site to site to site, and you really are tasting the mineral content of the soil. You'll taste sweetness, bitterness, mineral richness, or sometimes it's just very bland and, you know, just leafy. But it is the signature of the soil where it grows. Okay? As a being, that's what it's like. And it's no different to a human being, is it? You take the human being that's living out in a bender somewhere in the woods, that person's having a different experience to the person who's living down in the valley there in a teepee. And that person's having a different experience to the person who's living in suburbia somewhere. And we are a function, to some extent, of our environment, okay? So if we want to communicate with our environment, why not communicate with the plant kingdom? Because the plant kingdom stands in a way in between us and the world where we live. We consume it, we breathe its oxygen, and if we can accept that it is sentient, if it's conscious, then if we can communicate with it, it can tell us pretty much everything we need to know about how to live well here. Okay? So, that word, communicate, I think is really important. I think it's the crux of the whole matter. It's the centre of the whole deal. Okay? One of the things, probably the most profound thing that appears to me that Indigenous elders do when they work with plant spirits and they work with people to heal them using plant spirit medicine, okay, is they will use the spirit of the power plant as a guide to show them how to heal the individual and to take them maybe to other spirits, maybe to other plants. Maybe they will even then mix those other plants in along with the brew and give them to the person so they can both resonate with those energies together. But it's all about communication. It's about communication between the nature spirit world and the world of human beings. And without that communication, the whole experience is worthless, just nothing. Okay? So what this is all about, what this little workshop we're going to play around with in a moment, we'll do some exercises and things like that, is about maybe giving you a few tools to start communicating with the plant kingdom for yourselves in a different way. And some of you maybe already do this, you know, which is great. And also, if you can show me any techniques, I'd be greatly appreciative, because I believe we've all got a lot to learn and we're never going to stop learning. I think if you stop learning, you're dead. So I want you all to indulge me for a minute or two. I don't want to sort of spend hours and hours talking to you, really. I want you to do things.
There you go. That was Fred Gillam. Bit of a teaser for next week's show, because I think that next week, that's the wee bit of the chat that we're going to be looking into a bit more deeply, the animism and the ayahuasca and all the other things that you mentioned there. I think it's probably going to be a very interesting chat. So that'll be Fred Gillam talking to me live next week. It's all set up. So hopefully we shouldn't have a problem there. And that's about it. You've listened to a lot of Fred Gillam. You've seen some idea of what it is that Avalon Rising did at the Green Gathering. As many of you will know, I've been going to festivals for decades. I've been crewing at them for probably over 10 years now. And that was the biggest and most complicated. And, you know, it just worked really well. We did what we set out to do. And as I say, kind of running four talk venues for a whole weekend, that's a hell of a thing to organise to start with, and then a hell of a thing to execute. And as some of you with good memories will remember, the kitchen crew there, by the time we hit our peak on the Friday and Saturday night, we're feeding 60 people out of that wee tent. Quite an amazing thing to be done. So that's what we could do. Just imagine what it'd be like if all the people out there had, I don't know, some sort of, that were left with some of their resource, because by and large it is all taken off us and everything's being done on a shoestring as well, you know. Completely astonishing. If we actually had access to all of our skills and weren't allowing most of our income to be robbed from us, imagine what sort of event we could put on. Imagine how we could be getting on together. It could be truly amazing. And I certainly hope that I live to see that day. So we're coming about to the end. I've got another couple of tunes to play, but thanks to like everybody at Avalon Rising, thanks to the Green Gathering for still being there in whatever form, and thanks to all of you people who've been out there listening. Again, the chat box has been really active tonight, and that really does help, you know. It's really brilliant. If there's going to be some kind of performance, which this sort of is really, then it's really great to see an engaged audience. It makes all the difference in the world. And thanks to peoplesinternetradio.com for being there, to the Kitchen Posse who are out there at the moment, and were saying how much they appreciate the output of the station. I think it's really valuable what we're doing. Let's keep on doing it. And thanks for letting me be on here.